thought I would start by looking at this Apex case, which actually turns out to be quite a lot of fun, and then some general issues it raises, then take any questions you have on everything we've done, and if that doesn't get us to the end of the time, I will do my own summary of everything we've done. But let's start out with the Apex case. Looking at the sort of summary measures that income, assets, equity, does it look like the company's in good shape or not? What does their income look like? Assume you've already looked at all of this, since it was our assignment for today. Company in good shape? Not good shape? What do you think? Yeah, that's going to get to the assets, not the income. We'll get to that in just a minute. But yes, that's certainly one of the things that ought to be a warning signal to you. Let's take income for a moment. If you look at those figures, it looks pretty good. After all, the income in 2000, the income net income was $718,000, and this year it's $1 million. Does that seem like a convincing evidence the company's doing well? Is there anything on the balance sheets that might make, or the income statement, on any of these documents, which, other than your point about the unbilled accounts receivable, which are a little disturbing, anything else that rings alarm bells? Yeah? On the income, what you ought to notice is that they sold a chunk of land for a bunch of money. That's really not the business they're in. And without that, their income dropped a lot from last year. Yes, that's right. Without that, the income was less than last year. So that looks as though they're taking an undervalued asset and using it to make their income statement look better. You pointed out, that's the income point. Let's go to the assets. You pointed out that there's a whopping big chunk of, quote, unbilled accounts receivable, which presumably means we've sold them some stuff, we haven't sent them a bill for it, but we're sure they'll pay it someday. And there's also a very large, though not quite as large, accounts receivable, a good deal larger than the year before. Suppose one was suspiciously inclined and suspected all of that accounts receivable as being vapor. What happens to the owner's equity? Those two accounts receivable things come to just under $4 million. What does this say owner's equity is? Not much less, but less, $3 million something. So if one decides that one doesn't believe in those figures, and after all, those are in a sense the least solid figures out there, then equity goes negative. All right. Anything else that people noticed? What was the first thing that perhaps should have rung alarm bells looking at these? Yes?
There's not much cash.
That's right. The cash has dropped dramatically. Been dropping for 2 years. A year ago they had $565,000. Now they have $112,000. Again, the nice thing about cash is it's really hard to fake, and that therefore it provides a nice piece of evidence. Anything else that struck people? Yep.
Seems like our firm's old. Because we have depreciated assets. So I'm not sure what that tells us, but it's not a new firm with new assets anymore. It's our assets are so depreciated.
Yeah, well, that's not, I'm not really suspicious about that, anyone else? Yeah?
The difference in the inventory.
That's correct. In fact, if you look at it, if you look at your assets in detail, you observe that the most real assets, namely the cash and the inventory, have dropped to almost zero. That, and I guess prepaid expenses is in some sense real, and that the assets mostly consist of property, plants, equipment, and land whose value you don't know, and accounts receivable, billed or unbilled. which again makes you wonder. Anything else striking about these accounts? Yes?
I was going to say the prepaid expenses, the fact that they went down to 10 over years because they were fairly 185, 160,
yeah.
95. It's almost like they are holding back from using their cash to pay.
It might also mean that they're reducing production. It might be that they're really going out of business. That's why the inventory is low, and that's why they haven't been having many expenses to prepay. They're going down the tubes. Yes? Yes. She was pointing out that prepaid expenses had dropped quite a lot. And that's at least curious, that if the firm is doing well, if they're selling more goods, you would expect both inventory to go up, unless it was because they were selling so well that they were running out, and you would expect that they would have paid in advance for more of the stuff that they were doing. And, you know, I wouldn't call that a red flag in the sense of some of the others, but it's at least worth noting. Yeah?
Would we be concerned with the operating expenses going up?
Let's see. I hadn't looked. Let me, from the income. Let me take a look at that because I don't know. Operating expenses have gone up by a lot. You're right. I did not spot that one. And can we figure out? I don't think we can figure out why, but you're right. That is a little suspicious, again, that they in some way seem to be getting smaller and yet big operating expenses. Yeah? Long-term debt goes up. Debt goes down, I believe. Pretty sure that's right. Long-term debt goes up by $100,000 and short-term debt goes down by $200,000. But if you look at that, what's the curious thing if you look at the debt situation a little bit more carefully? Take a look at what happens to interest payments. What happens to interest expense? It's interest expense has doubled even though total debt has gone down. What does that suggest to you? That they're being paid a very high risk, charged a high risk premium for that long-term loan probably. All right, so again, you might not want to hitch your career to this particular... yep?
Their income tax payable is $101,000 as compared to $24,000.
Take a look at me. Yeah, their income tax payable has gone up by a lot, and I don't know how we interpret that, except that they claim to have had a higher net income. But I don't know enough about income tax to guess what that's.
I mean, that's like
it's big.
Huge.
It is big. But
maybe possibly they may have had to pay more tax on the land. I don't
know. Or it might also have been that the previous year they had some large deduction that they ran out. I don't know. No, the other point that struck me was the dividends. All right, you've got a company that's practically out of money and it's just given its stockholders $1 million. Right? If you look at the cash flow statement, dividends paid stockholders are more than $1 million. And this is in a company which, even if you believe their accounting, that leaves it with an equity of $3 million something. And we're suspicious as to whether there's really any equity at all. So suppose you're suspiciously inclined, how might you interpret this whole story? That's right. It sort of looks as though, for whatever reason, they're winding down the operation and they're transferring the cash to the stockholders, maybe planning to end up with sizable negative equity. Maybe those operating expenses were really bogus. Maybe they're paying big salaries to the chief stockholder. I don't know what's going on. But I think what I thought was neat about this example, just reading it, is how with the even rather limited knowledge we have accounting, those numbers say things to you. Those numbers say, here is a suspicious number. Here is something we ought to be worried about. Here is something which looks as though they're trying to make things look better than they are, and so forth. And that seemed to me was quite neat looking at those accounts. And you might think about the sort of general issue this raises. Imagine that you're the CEO of a company, and you have a good deal of leverage over the accountants, and you want its balance sheet to look good because you're trying to get a loan or issue new stock or justify your own bonus or for any other reason. What are the legal steps that you take to make it look good? You inflate assets where you can. You maybe, as in this income case, you take some undervalued piece of property and sell it, thus looking as though you've just made lots of money this year, and so forth. You could turn it around. Suppose you want the balance sheet to look bad. Suppose you're some friends of yours with lots of money are planning to take the company private. You want to buy out the stockholders as cheaply as possible. You could then imagine reversing those kinds of policies. So it's worth thinking about that, not only because you might be consulting some consulting for some CEO who wanted to do these things, but you also might be consulting for somebody who wanted to know whether the CEO was doing those things. So again, I mean, you're really going to need professional accountants to do this right, but at least if you understand the logic of it, you're in a better position than you were before. All right, that was really what I wanted to say about those things. So let me now, as per my usual practice, see what questions you have, except that this time, since it's the last class before the midterm, you hopefully have been going through and figuring out what you don't understand, if anything. Anybody? All perfectly clear? Yep.
I just had questions about what the test will be like tomorrow. Will it just be entire class period?
Entire class period. I try to design my tests so that a majority of the students are finished before the end. I actually overdid it with my other midterm last week so that everybody was finished like 5 minutes before the end. My basic theory is the tests where everybody is scribbling to the last minute, a lot of what's being rewarded is being fast rather than knowing the stuff, and that it is desirable to be able to do stuff fast, but it's a lot less important than being able to do it right, and therefore I've shifted away from that over the years, and I try to design them. Now, there's some selfish element as well, because a six-question exam that everybody finishes with plenty of time is a lot easier to grade than a 12-question exam where people have last-minute scribbling all over it. So there's some selfish element as well as non-selfish. Yes?
Will they look, in terms of the types of problems, obviously not exactly
vaguely like the previous ones.
So yeah. If we look at those and we take them and we can do well, then we should feel confident.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I will try to avoid having any question that was on the previous midterm. Not perfectly, but that generally I avoid that. But the same general approach, that's right. And one thing you may or may not have noticed on the previous midterm is the note at the top about skipping questions. I haven't given you my talk about this. This is my explanation of the application of economics to my job, which is being a professor. That one of the economic problems with being a professor has to do with exams. Suppose you are taking an exam and you've answered all the questions you know the answer to and you've still got 10 minutes left. What's the obvious thing to do?
Stop.
It's not the obvious thing to do. It's what I want you to do. It's not the what?
Go back.
You can check your answers. What else can you do?
Yes.
You've got some other questions you don't know the answer to. You could call it guess, I would call it BS, but you can try to write something that you hope, especially if your handwriting isn't very good. I will see part of the right answer in it whether or not you know it, and so you can get a few extra points. All right? Now, you're doing this, impose the cost on you. You could be out enjoying the nice weather, assuming we have nice weather tomorrow, instead of scribbling madly away. It imposes the cost on me because I've then got to grade those things. And it reduces the accuracy of the grading process, because I could get fooled in both directions. I might give credit to somebody who doesn't understand the question just because I think he does, and I might withhold credit from somebody who doesn't understand the question because I mistakenly think he's just pretending when he doesn't. So I decided a long time ago I should do something about this, about altering incentives, which is what economics is largely about. And I remember the story of why Socrates was the wisest man in Athens, which of course all of you know, that Socrates was told by the Delphic Oracle that he was the wisest man in Athens. And he was very puzzled at this because he didn't know anything. And he went around talking to other Athenians, and eventually he concluded that the oracle was correct. They didn't know anything either, but they thought they did. And so I decided that on my exams, you get credit for knowing that you don't know things. And so my standard rule ever since has been that on any complete question, this does not apply if I've got a two-part question to any one part, but any full question with its own number of points for it, you can either leave it blank or write, I don't know, and you get 20%. And hopefully, if I've calculated it correctly, that means that it's not in your interest to pretend to know things you don't know, and that saves you time and saves me time. So I figured I'd tell you about that in advance, since...
So if, say, we partially know, and so we make an attempt.
You've got to decide whether you think you know more than 20%.
But I mean, if we know more than 20%, we will technically we get more than 20%. It's not like you answer wrong.
No, no.
Okay.
No, no, of course. I lots of questions get 9 out of 10 or 8 out of 10 or 7 out of 10 on exams that I give. The other thing I should tell you is that I don't usually design exams so that an A is 90% and a B is 80% or whatever. I design exams to try to find out what people know, basically, as best I can. And when you get the exam back, I'll tell you what the mean was, and that can give you a reasonable idea of how you're doing. But, you know, if there are 80 questions and the mean is 50, that doesn't mean everybody failed. It just means it was a hard exam. Other questions? So no questions about the course, just questions about the exam. It is closed book, as my things are. You're welcome to bring a calculator, though I doubt you'll need one. I'll do it on paper. I generally try to set it up so you can actually answer the questions on the exam itself. You can write on the back. I try to leave an amount of space that gives you a rough idea about how long I expect the answer to, but if you're writing big or have more to say, you can use backs of pages and stuff. Yeah.
On both of your previous midterms, there was sort of a scenario, and the objective was to write out who's incentivized to do what in what way. So it's kind of, I guess, your contract area question. As far as, is it more important to show that we understand that you're trying, the point of the contract is to maximize the gain both parties get.
And understand how you do it.
But there's no specific, because if you think of a different incentive,
If you think of a legitimate answer, unless I don't realize this legitimate answer, that's fine. I had the experience. I've just been grading my law and econ midterm, and there was one of the questions where there was an answer which my first instinct was to mark wrong, and then I realized that although it wasn't the answer I was looking for, given what I had written, it was another possible answer to the question. So it had to do with the economic efficiency question, with what are reasons that a reasonable person might not agree that the more efficient legal rule was better. And I was thinking about reasons having to do with why it wasn't better for the world. But some people's response was, it might not be better for me, even though it's good for the world. Well, that's a reason, you know, reasonable. Something unreasonable about being selfish. It's a very common human pattern of behavior. And so I said that I had to give credit for that, even though if I'd written the exam more carefully, I wouldn't have. Anyway. All right, so other questions? Yes? About a third. I should say the answer to that question is less unambiguous than it sounds, because students always assume that there's a clear answer to that question, but it's not clear what it means. And the way I like to put it is, suppose that I was at a university which for some reason had rules requiring the midterm and the final to have the same weight, and suppose I wanted the final to have twice the weight of the midterm. How do I arrange it? Both of them have 100 points. The first question on the midterm for 50 points is, what is your name? All right. So it's really a 50-point question. And the point of that is that what really is relevant to weighting is not how I add up the numbers, but how much the two exams vary. If one of the exams has questions such that everybody gets a score between 80 and 85, and I just add up its score to the other one, which varied much more widely, it's going to be the other one that determines what happens. So generally what I do is to calculate standard deviation, which tells me how much it's spreading. If it's roughly similar for the two, I can just use the numbers. If it isn't, what I do is to convert both exam scores to number of standard deviations from the mean and weight that. All right. Yes? The final covers everything with heavier weight after the midterm. My theory, which is hard to follow very precisely, is that all parts of the course are equally weighted when you combine the midterm and the final. And since the final has heavier weight than the midterm, the way you do that is put a little bit of the stuff from before the midterm on the final, but not very much. Yes?
Let's say our class is about 10 people, maybe a little more. Are you going to impose a curve?
Nah, not in any very meaningful sense. That is, I don't believe I'm required to impose a curve, probably I should be on the whole. We can discuss the whole question of required curves, which is another interesting question, actually sort of a mathematical question in some ways. But no, what I normally do is a curve only in the sense that I say, well, reading these exams, these students are doing better than average, so maybe I should have, you know, a little bit high, more high grades and low, fewer lower, or they're doing a little worse, but I don't have any preset.
They don't aim towards a conceptual curve.
Yeah, I guess you could put it that way. In the sense, if I have an exam and it turns out that the highest score is 50%, unless it's clear from the exam that that really means that nobody learned anything, I'm not going to fail everybody, obviously. On the other hand, I wouldn't predict that every year I'll have the same percentage of A's, B's, C's, and so forth, because that'll partly depend on, you know, if I have a class where there are three students who all have very good exams, all about equally good, I'm going to give them all about the same grade. Whereas if there's a, and in the other direction, if there's one person who's, you know, down way below everybody else, then I get one F or one D or something, which I don't like to do, but that's hard to say. If you, that all doing well is going to be one of the things that will affect how I see your result. But no, if the worst score is somebody who looks to me like he learned two-thirds of what I'm teaching, he's going to get a, you know, a C or a B minus or something, because that's what I think of as... But if the best score is somebody who learned half of what I'm teaching, then he's not going to get an A. Right? Hope that makes sense. Anyway. I don't like the whole grading business, but it is a part of what we have to do. How do people feel about compulsory curves? I'm curious. The compulsory curve, about as you probably know, it's sort of an issue in the school for a long time, and they have, for certain courses, there's a constraint on what distribution of grades a professor can give. And various people are for it, and various people are against it, and the argument... One argument for it is that otherwise it's unfair because students figure out which professor is an easy grader and they take his classes and then they're getting better grades and the student learn more in the hard grader kind of thing. And the standard counter argument is yes, but not all classes are the same and I shouldn't be constrained to give fewer A's than the students deserve and so forth. And I was just curious whether students had opinions on this. Yeah? One of the things I normally try to do when at the very end, when I'm giving letter grades, I don't really think about letter grades at the midterm level, is to see if there are clusters. That is to try to set it so that the division between letter grades is a division where there are and try not so far as I can to put them where they're equal very close to each other. Yeah.
It seems to me like curves and non-curves just represent two different values. If you value competition, then a curve is the smart way to go. But if you value simply learning material, then a curve is not necessarily the way to go.
All right, I guess I'm not sure I think of it as valuing competition. I would have said, if you just think, suppose you just think of it as a way of reporting information to future employers, to you yourself, and so forth. And then the argument is that without a curve, the information is being muddied up by the variations among the professors, that the easy grader professor is telling people, is telling, this, as it were, the same person that you're great when the hard grading person is telling the person he's not very great, and that's the counter-argument.
But in that case, in that case, then, a curve seems like a very roundabout, indirect way of correcting the problem.
How else would you correct you? You're running a university, which is basically a faculty-run firm. That's one of the interesting features of sort of standard universities is they're really employer-run firms in practice, mostly. Each of those employees believes that his judgment is superior. How would you go about controlling it? I mean, it's a real organization problem.
Employ, objective standards.
What are objective? How could you employ objective standards? I'm the only person teaching this course. How do we figure out whether you knew more, learned more about analytic methods for lawyers than someone else in another class learned about evidence? What is an objective standard?
Not objective standards for what grade you give, but objective standards for how you give your grades.
I don't understand how you have an objective. I could understand, perhaps, for some courses, an objective standard for deciding which student is better than which. But how do you get an objective standard for deciding whether the best student is an A or an A minus, whether the worst student is a C or a D? What's an objective standard for that?
I don't think it, I mean, I agree that it's difficult, but I don't agree that it's impossible.
All right, I don't see how, it, in principle, you would do it. Yeah.
In business school, they don't have these force curves.
Yes.
They some progressive curve clock down or move the grade until like 90 becomes the new A instead of 100. And, but at the business school, like, really hard with the econ teacher, and he's the only one who teaches it. And they only recently added someone who teaches two classes in the summer, and everybody wants to finish that one because they know they'll get like B or C.
Right.
No matter how well they do, they'll get B or C.
Right.
And there's no person in that class. And he can give us whatever.
Yes.
The class scale or whatever. And just like there's a finance teacher who teaches less of the core concepts, they want you to know at the end of the course, and so all the teachers who are at the end of the course.
Let me just for one further digression before I go on to what I was going to talk about, and that's if you want to do a curve, how you would do it right, which I'm not certainly this school has never tried. I'm not sure that anyone has ever done. So this is an idea from Gordon Tullock, who is a crazy and ingenious and original economist. He's fairly old now, but was a colleague of mine once. And his proposal is you have a see one of the problems that we haven't mentioned with the curve is suppose we've got one class which really appeals to the really good ambitious students. Who are all A students in their other classes. And we've got another one that really appeals to the students who are barely making buys. We've got all C students. Give them the same curve, and the result is that you're giving some of those A students Cs and some of those C students As, even if they're performing at their normal level. So Tullock's idea is that you start out with information on the students, say the first year grades, because everybody's taking the same first year courses. You then have a curve for each class based on the grade point average of the students entering that class. So if you have a class where the students, judging by their first year performance, are well above average, it's allowed to set a high curve, and one where they're well below, it's a low curve. So that's, if you sort of just think about the logic of the system, it's sort of an ingenious idea for how you can make it at least closer to the right. But let me drop that technical overview. To me, an interesting subject. Part of the point of doing economics or law or anything else is seeing how you can apply the ideas to the world immediately around you in the life you're actually living. But let me do my sort of whirlwind review. And the first subject we discussed was decision analysis. And decision analysis is really a way of formally setting up the sort of problems that everybody is setting up informally anyway about deciding how to do something. And the analysis itself doesn't provide the data. You've got to provide the data. The analysis is really a way of structuring your sort of logical analysis and say, given these facts, what should I do? So the information you need is what are the choices you're going to have to make? What are the branches in this graph, as it were? What are the probabilities of various outcomes if we go to trial? How likely are we to prevail? What are the payoffs if we prevail? How much will we get? If we don't prevail, how expensive will the litigation be? So drawing the decision analysis graph doesn't tell you the answers, but it does tell you some of the questions. You've got, if you remember how we did it, you know, you've got this graph here, and you say, well, here is a choice we have to make, go to trial or settle. Here is a random outcome. Here is something with the outcome going each way, and so forth. What does that tell us? We're going to have to find out payoffs here, costs of making these two choices, probabilities here, and so forth. So it's simply a more organized way of thinking through the decisions you're going to make. And you do it setting up, as I was just showing, a graph which shows the alternatives you choose, alternatives chosen by chance with their probabilities, the outcomes with their payoffs. And how do you analyze the graph? You start at the right end. You say, if we got this, if we get to this point, what on average, how good is it be at this point? Well, the probability of going here times this payoff plus the probability of going here times that payoff. That's the value of getting to here. Do that for everything, and now we say, all right, well, we're choosing between this and this, which is the higher value for us. All right. And basically, at each point where you make a decision, you look at the last decision you make, expected outcomes from each alternative, pick the higher expected outcome, that's the value of getting to that point, and just work back. So you could do it for as many layers as you wanted. And you can then cut off whatever the lower ones are. So if we say, well, at this point, we've got a choice. This path leads to good. This path leads to bad. Cut off that one. And we've just simplified the graph now down and so forth. So it's a fairly straightforward mechanism, but it is useful to know how to do it. And so where you get the information to set it up, you get it from your expert knowledge. You're a litigator. You've been through such cases before. You get it from your client. You say to your client, just how bad a thing would it be to be found liable here? And it may not just be the money. It may be reputational differences as well. How bad a thing would it be to you to lose $100,000? How important is it to make $1 million? Questions like that that are trying to figure out what the real payoffs. And in some cases, you might actually do research. If you're talking about large sums of money, it might be worth doing some trials with you know, fake juries, as it were. It might be worth doing some statistical analysis of the last 20 cases like this and so forth. This decision analysis doesn't say how to do that. It just points you at what are the questions that you're going to want to ask. Something else you might want to do if you're being fancier about it is sensitivity analysis. You could say, well, look, I have concluded we should do this. How badly wrong do I have to be about some of these numbers to reverse that conclusion? Is this a very solid conclusion where we say, well, any reasonable guess about the payoff, this is the right thing to do? Or is it very iffy, in which case maybe we should look a little more carefully at the whatever the relevant things are? And obviously, one of the things you're going to want to think about in talking to your client is risk aversion. The question is, you can't just say the way a sort of somebody analyzing games is likely to say, well, the payoff here is the probability of this outcome times its payoff plus the probability of this outcome times the payoff. That's the right rule if you're doing this 1,000 times, because that's what you're going to get on average, but it's not the right rule doing it once, so you're going to have to ask your customer, given that we've got this probability of this outcome, this probability of this outcome, what's that equivalent to for you? So some customers are risk neutral. That makes life really easy for your arithmetic, but not all of them are. So any questions on decision theory? I think probably my sample exams, I'm guessing, probably included at least one decision theory problem. And I don't know if I'll have one this time, but if I do, it'll be that sort of thing. Here is a story. Draw the diagram, fill in the numbers, which I'm going to give you the information for, figure out what you should do. That would be the basic logic of a decision theory problem. Yep?
If you got two sham throws, can you just converge them by multiplying probabilities?
Yeah, if you have two in succession, suppose you have two chance nodes before any decisions. All right? In that case, the probability of going here is the probability of this branch times the probability of this branch. That's just probability theory, right? That's not payoffs. So sure, but you normally wouldn't bother. That is, you would just. And in fact, we normally do condense it in the sense, if you think about it, you know, your trial outcome is really a set of probabilistic events, but all you're really interested in is the probability of the final results. And the right. Any questions on decision theory, which is, I suppose, the easiest thing we've done so far. All right. Then the next chunk, which I suppose conceptually is the hardest thing we've done, only we only did a little tiny bit of it, is game theory. And game theory is trying to analyze these situations where there's another human being, at least one other human being involved, and he's trying to achieve his objectives, you're trying to achieve yours. What he gets is conditional on what you do. What you do gets conditional on what he does. You can use threats, you can use bluffs, you can use bribes. You have the whole sort of repertoire of human interaction. All right? In that case, straight decision theory isn't enough, although something analogous can sometimes be used. There really isn't, I think, a clear answer to what will happen in any game. The game theory is not a solved problem. But there are little bits and pieces of solution, as it were, and we can identify particular games that have interesting features and that come up in real life. And bilateral monopoly bargaining gives a sort of nice, simple example of a two-player, non-fixed-sum game. It's a non-fixed-sum game. The players are not pure opponents. All right, pure opponents. Anything that helps you hurts me, anything that helps me hurts you. Bilateral monopoly, there's something that hurts both of us, namely failing to sell the apple, failing to reach agreement, whatever the particular context is. So therefore, it's not fixed sum. We've got a common interest in reaching an agreement, but a divergence of interest on the terms of the agreement. All right, and that's a very common situation. If you think about what's going on in Libya at this very moment, presumably they have a common interest in Gaddafi's people and the rest of the population stopping shooting at each other. But Gaddafi, and it presumably, if there is some level of there might be some level of continued civil war, such that either side would rather surrender than have it. That's what Gaddafi is trying to persuade the other side of. He's basically saying, look, I can kill a million of you if necessary. You aren't willing to accept that as the price of getting rid of me. Therefore, I'll give you some minor reforms and, you know, go home again. And the other side isn't willing to go there. But, of course, the other side could equally well say yes, but given that we're willing to keep fighting for the last drop of blood, you are better off taking $1 billion that you've, with any luck, got in the Swiss bank account and leaving Libya to the rest of us. And between those two, each side is trying to persuade the other that they're not going to back down and therefore get their end of the bargaining, if that makes sense. And if you think of any union management bargaining, a lot of foreign policy of, you know, Israel versus the various Palestinian organizations, all of those involve cases where, I don't know, I think it's at least arguable that there's quite a range of settlements of what's happening in the Middle East that both Israel and the Palestinian Authority would prefer to continue conflict. And yet, each one has an incentive to sort of try to play it strong in the hope of getting a settlement closer to what they want. Now, maybe there is none. There's a possibility that there are bargains where there is no bargaining range. Maybe the apple is really worth more to me who has it than to you who is buying it. But even if there is one, people are going to spend resources trying to move the counter, as it were, in their direction. And one of the ways you do that is, there are at least two ways you do it. One of them is commitment strategies. That is somehow tying your hands, somehow setting it up so that here is my offer and it would cost me too much to back down from it. And that's a very common pattern. And if you think again about something like the Israeli-Palestinian case, there are real ways of doing that because the actors are not Israel and the Palestinians. They're a particular Israeli politician and a particular Palestinian politician. And an Israeli politician may be able to set things up so he knows he will be voted out of office if he doesn't get a certain deal. And if he can persuade his opposite number of that, then the opposite number knows there's no point in pushing you farther than that. And others, it's just psychological, just saying, I'd be ashamed to back down under these circumstances. The other possible strategy for bilateral monopoly is to mislead the other party about what something's worth to you. So that if you're the guy who's trying to buy the apple, then I'm the one who's selling it, and if you can make it look as though you don't really value apples very much, then you're in a position to get me to cut my price. And again, the danger is if you do it too well, it might be that there's really a bargaining range, there really is a price at which we're both better off with the transaction, but between us we've persuaded each other that there isn't, because you have pretended the apple's worth less to you than it really is, I've pretended it's worth more to me than it really is, and both of us did it so well that there was no transaction possible. Right? So that's bilateral monopoly, and it's a very, very simple game, but nonetheless I think it's an informative one to try to think about. That's a two-player game. When you go from there to a many-player game, you add in the possibility of coalitions. You add in that he and I can gang up on her, or the three of you can gang up on me, or things of that sort. And that gives a further element of strategic behavior as to who allies with whom on what terms. There are a number of ways you can represent a game. And one of the ways is one that looks a lot like decision theory as a series of choices. And the difference between
the decision theory version and the game theory version is that the decision theory version, some of the choices are by one player and some are by the other. So you could imagine a game as having some structure like that. I'm not putting any random ones, but there can be random ones as well. So what's happening? Player first, play one makes a move. If player one makes this move, player two then gets to make a move and can make either of these, and so forth. If player one went down here, we would have another sequence of things. All right, so you can think of diagramming it just the way we diagram decision theory, except there are now two players instead of one. All right, makes sense. Not all games can be done that way. There are games where scissors, paper, stone can't be done that way because you're moving simultaneously. But some games, if you think about one of the places where this has been used is bankruptcy. If you say, all right, somebody decides to throw it into bankruptcy, there is now a decision to be made by various of the claimants. There's now a decision to be made by, I don't know, I've never done bankruptcy stuff, but when people do it, this is one of the methods they can try to use to think of as a sequence of steps like that. And then there's quite a simple and elegant way of solving that kind of game, which is really analogous to what we were doing before with the decision theory. And that's what we call subgame perfect equilibrium. Now, you don't, probably won't be able to tell me that word, but you probably should recognize it if I use it. It's jargon. But the basic idea is that you go all the way to the right end. Let's take one maybe where there's a random here, and then decisions here, and finally payoffs for both parties at the end. And you can say, well, all right, suppose I'm orange at the last step. Which decision will I make? Well, that one's easy. Whichever one has a higher payoff. So this is the higher payoff, say. We can cut off that. If I got to here, what would I do? Well, this is the higher payoff. Cut off that. All right, so far. Now I've just simplified the diagram. Now I know as blue that if I go here, I'm going to end up with that payoff. And if I go here, I'm going to end up with that payoff. Well, then what's easy? Blue says, which of these is the higher payoff for me? Think of each of these bullets, as it were, as having two numbers, the payoff to orange and the payoff to blue. So blue says, aha, this one has a higher payoff to blue than this one does. So blue can now cut off that branch. Sorry, that was a random one. I shouldn't have said that. I'm going to reverse this. There's a random here. We're going to not worry about what goes there. And then there's a square here. All right. That's what I was thinking. So now blue says, aha, cut off this branch. Now we know that if we get to this random with some probability, we go here. If we get to this one on the random with some probability, we go to the equivalent of another network. So we know the value of getting here. Now, orange can say, well, how does the value of that compare with the value of this in the same way? So you're just working right to left, cutting off branches as you go, and by the time you're back to here, this guy knows the payoff from either of these choices that takes the higher benefit one. Does that make sense? So that's a sort of one of the cleaner and tidier bits of game theory, and the problem is that it requires a game which has the structure that we're showing here, the structure of a sequence of alternating choices, and which is being played once with no commitment strategies. Because once there are commitment strategies, then there's the possibility that orange will say to himself, I don't want blue to make this choice. Because if blue makes this choice and I make this choice, I get a pretty poor outcome. Not quite as bad as this one, but a pretty poor outcome. On the other hand, if blue makes this choice, one of these outcomes is pretty good. So what I want to do is to say to blue, look, I know you're doing this subgame perfect nonsense, but don't believe it. I have tied myself to the mast. I have set things up so that if we ever get to here, I am going to go there and not there, and boy, you're not going to like that outcome. So therefore, blue says, well, in that case, I'm going to have to go here. Orange then has a better alternative. All right. So once you allow for such commitment strategies, you now have a world where
some came from equilibrium, doesn't necessarily give the right answer. And as you will probably remember, my favorite version of this is the tantrum game, where the question is putting your little girl to bed when you're having a dinner party. And subgame equilibrium demonstrates conclusively mathematical rigor that the girl will go to bed like an angel, there'll be no problem. Doesn't work that way. And it doesn't work that way because little girls, just like the rest of us, engage in commitment strategies. And she, at some level, explicit or implicit, realizes that going to bed like a little angel means that the next party you're also going to send her to bed, and the party after that you'll also send her to bed. Whereas if you make it clear that she's going to throw a fit, even though it does her no good this time, that'll change your incentives for next time. All right. So as I say, subgame perfect equilibrium is nice as far as it goes, but it's got some limits. Okay. Another possible approach, and one which can be used for quite a lot of games, is a matrix. Matrix shows the choices player one can make here, the choices player two can make here. Ultimately, a pair of choices give you an outcome, and the outcome is, let's call this 1, call this 2, and the outcome is some payoff on each of these for 1, and some payoff on each of these for 2. Alright, put that in every box. And that, it turns out, is actually a very, very general way of thinking about this. Because any game of this sort could be reduced to that if you think of those rows and columns as showing strategies. So a strategy is simply a full description of what you will do in every situation. Think of it like a computer program. So I say, I as blue say my strategy is, first, go here. If he goes there, go that way. If he goes there, go that way. And so forth. Full description, everything conditional. If he does this, this is what I'll do. Well, there's some finite number of strategies. Put all my strategies down here. Put all your strategies here. Each cell shows what happens if I play that strategy and you play that strategy. You can imagine two computer programs going in and they're just playing the game while we watch. All right? Does that make sense? So it's a rather powerful way of reducing a lot of different games to the same formalism. That's what von Neumann did in his one solved case, which is fixed sum. What we usually call zero-sum games for two players, where he did in fact show in some sense a solution, which there's no good reason why you should know a whole lot about, except it's sort of neat. But in general, you can reduce games to that form. And having reduced it to that form, then one of the possible solution concepts is dominance. Dominance occurs when there is some strategy, say this one for this player, where this player's payoff is higher with that strategy whatever the other one does. And there's a strategy for this player where whatever the other player does, this is his best strategy. So that's the simple case. Prisoner's Dilemma is a perverse example of that. It's a case where each player is better off confessing whatever the other one does. And that gives you a nice unambiguous sense of what's going to happen. But there's no reason to expect all games, or even most games, to be like that. Again, if you think of scissors, paper, stone, in that sense, there isn't a dominant strategy. I discussed, I think, a little bit the idea of showing points, the idea of reaching a particular outcome because both players see it as unique and bargaining is expensive. So if you imagine the bank robbers deciding how to split the loot, which they've got to do very quickly before the police show up, 50-50 may not seem fair to either of them, but both of them sees that as a unique outcome, whereas 53-47 isn't. So 53-47 invites further bargaining, 50-50 doesn't. And that certainly is one of the ways we observe people settling things of this sort. I also mentioned Nash equilibrium. Nash equilibrium is a solution concept for many player games where the basic idea is each player is following a strategy such that given the strategies of all the other players, mine is the best one for me. And that's true for everybody. And that is need not be unique. Everyone driving on the right and everyone driving on the left are both Nash equilibria. And it may or may not be stable once you imagine coordination among the players. That it's stable as long as each player acts separately, because each player, given what everybody else is doing, is worse off if he does anything other than what he's doing. but it might be that two players together could both change together and be better off. That was my example of the two escaping convicts rushing the guard. So, but that's another useful concept for thinking about many-player games. And the chapter also briefly discusses insurance issues, and in particular moral hazard and adverse selection. Moral hazard is the fact that when you've insured your factory, you now have greatly reduced your incentive to keep it from burning down. And adverse selection is the fact that your choosing to buy life insurance is at least a weak signal that you expect to die. And if you expect to die, they ought to charge you a high price for life insurance. And if anybody who buys life insurance gets charged a high price on the theory you probably expect to die, then people who don't expect to die are unlikely to buy life insurance. And that's a very, very common problem. It's, in a sense, the problem that is at the center of the current legal controversy over Obamacare, because the legal controversy is over the mandate, over saying there's a penalty if you don't buy insurance. And what was the argument for the mandate? It was that if you insist that insurance companies have to be willing to insure you, even if you're already sick when you show up, then you get adverse selection, because then people wait until they're sick to buy insurance, which saves them lots of money, in which case the insurance companies now can't pay you when you're sick because they don't have any well people paying in to make up for the cost. Therefore, the argument is you have to require everybody to buy insurance. Perfectly legitimate argument. Whether it's constitutional is something we will find out whether the Supreme Court thinks it's constitutional is something we'll find out sometime in the next year or so. Whether it's a good thing is a much more complicated question, but that was the basic argument. So it was an adverse selection argument for the mandate. I should say what makes the present situation a little tricky is the fact that the Democrats lost their majority. The Democrats still have the majority of the Supreme Court could say, well, the mandate's unconstitutional for these reasons, and then they could go back and do the same thing in a somewhat different form, make it explicitly a tax, clearly constitutional, but they can't do that because they don't have the votes anymore. So that's sort of an odd situation where the legal outcome is where almost the legal accident of whether this particular way of doing what they wanted is constitutional can determine whether or not the whole program stands or falls. Let's see. There was an interesting, I don't know if I remember, I discussed it, I don't think I discussed it in class, but there's an interesting blog post by somebody who was asking, why doesn't adverse selection destroy the adultery market? And the argument is very simple. If he is the kind of bum who is being willing to be unfaithful to his wife and then dump her to marry you, is he really the kind of guy you want to be married to? Well, if not, then what's the point of having the affair in the first place? And isn't that an adverse selection kind of effect, that being willing to have a married man being willing to have an affair with you is evidence that he's the kind of person you don't want to leave his wife and marry you? Which obviously would be a problem if you're a naturally faithful person who wants to have affairs. But then, if you're a naturally faithful person, you probably don't want to have affairs. But it was an interesting discussion. I just noticed I had it in my notes and thought I would pass it on to you. All right, so any questions on game theory plus little bits of insurance, which is what that chapter was? Yes?
How does the asymmetric information work into that?
Sure. The asymmetric, that is in the particular case of Obamacare, it's asymmetric by legislation. That is to say, the insurance company may know you're sick, but they're not allowed to use that information in setting their prices or deciding whether to accept you.
Does asymmetric information describe the solution, or is that just
asymmetric information? The sort of classic adverse selection is where one party has the information, the other one doesn't. And Obamacare is sort of a equivalent of that, where even if both parties have the information, it's against the law for one of them to use it. Make sense? So if you could imagine, if you think about the market for lemons, which I think I discussed, which is the used car version of adverse selection, you could imagine a situation where I can hire a mechanic to check the car and tell me if it's a lemon or a grit cream, in which case there's no adverse selection problem until somebody says that's unfair to people who own lemons, and therefore it's going to be illegal for you to hire a mechanic to do that. You'd then be back to that. Well, in fact, Obamacare is like that, except that it's a lot more plausible to say it's unfair to allow them to charge people who, by bad luck, have cancer
more than people who buy good ones don't. That's more plausible to most people than saying it's unfair for them to be allowed to pay less for lemons than free lemons. But in terms of the logic of it, the mathematics or the economics, it's the same case. The guy who has cancer is a lemon from the standpoint of the insurance company. It's going to cost them a lot of money. And the guy who's got wonderful health and he'll live to 103 is a cream puff. He's going to pay them insurance money and never collect anything. So it's the same logic.
All right, so the next thing we talked about was contracting. And the basic idea that the book is focusing on is how do you maximize the total gains of the two parties from the contract. And obviously that's not the only thing that's going on in negotiations. People are also trying to bargain for as much as of the gain as possible to go to them. But that's at least one large thing going on, is the thing the two can cooperate on, and is the thing that the chapter is really about. And so their basic answer is that you maximize the gain by giving people the right incentives. What does that mean? It means if a particular action produces a combined benefit of $15,000 and costs $10,000, it'll happen. If it produces a combined benefit of $5,000 and costs $10,000, it won't happen. All right, that's the sort of underlying strategy. What something is that? What materials do you use to build a house? How long do you search for low prices? Whether or not you breach the contract, those are all decisions. So you'd like to set up your contract so that if breaching it produces net benefits, if it's going to cost me $50,000 to complete the contract and you'll only lose $30,000 if I breach it, then we want to set it up so I'll breach, possibly compensating you in the process, depending on the terms of our agreement. Whereas if you reverse the numbers, you want to set it up so that I won't breach. Similarly for all of these other decisions that we're imagining. And in fact, if you think about it, moral hazard is really in the same group of problems. If we set things up so that some act that I have imposes costs, half of which go to you, then I'm not going to make the right decision of how to take that act. So we want as nearly as possible to set up our contract so that decisions I make, I get the benefit and bear the cost. Decisions you make, you get the benefit and bear the cost. And then each of us will have an incentive to make the decision. All of the cost, all of the benefit. And then each of us has an incentive to make those decisions where benefits are larger than cost and not those where there are. Is that sort of underlying principle clear enough? Because that's really the basic principle running through all of this. And one of the things that might occur to you if you were taking a law and econ class instead of an analytics methods class is that this really is the same approach that you would like to set up in tort law. Maybe even in criminal law. You want a set of rules. You can think of a contract as a little baby legal system for two people that they construct. And the underlying approach is the same one. You'd like to set up your tort law rules so that if I am making a decision about whether to get my brakes checked, I'll do it if the combined benefit to me and everybody who I might run into is larger than the cost. And maybe tort law tries to do that by saying, if I run into you, I got to pay your bills. All right, so you can think of this as a general approach to how you design an efficient legal system, only we're only looking at it in this book so far in the very narrow context of designing the two-party legal system that a contract consists of. All right, does that make sense as a way of thinking about it? Part of the fun of economic analysis of law is the degree to which you discover that all law is one thing, that the same basic arguments and analysis is run right across practically everything. We may come back to that in another month or so. And we looked at the specific case of construction contracts, where one basic form is fixed price. We agree what I'll pay you. And that has the advantage that you have an incentive to minimize cost. But it has the disadvantage that you will minimize costs even in ways where money cost is held down, because that's what you're paying, but cost in some other dimensions, such as the quality of the house I end up, goes to me, and therefore if you save $1,000 and make a $2,000 worse house, it'll pay you to do it, and that's not a good arrangement. So that's the tension, as it were, is between the fixed price contract giving you an incentive to hold down visible costs, as it were, but no incentive not to do so at an expense in invisible costs. And a cost plus incentive, you now have at least no incentive to skimp on quality, though no particular reason to reduce it except for later reputation and such. But you now have no incentive to minimize your cost. And you can then first choose among these according to which problems you think are hardest to control. If you're hiring somebody to do something where quality is easy to define, you can then say, all right, we're going to have a fixed price contract, and the contract says you only get paid if you produce a house of this quality. If you have something where quality is very hard to measure, and where, on the other hand, it's pretty easy to tell whether he's doing it the cheapest possible way, where input costs are easy to measure, then you can say, well, I'll pay the costs, and the contract just says, here are some rules to make sure you aren't pocketing the money that you say you're paying to your suppliers. All right? In between then, those, you pick one of the rules and then try to make additional terms in the contract to control what's wrong with that rule. So if the rule is fixed price, you then try to find ways of specifying quality. If the rule is cost plus, you try to find ways of limiting how much of your money you can spend in effect. And we looked at some other issues. In particular, one of the forms of contract is one where you pay by results. For example, a contingency fee for a law firm, or commissions for a salesman. And we discussed particular sorts of contracts, such as principal agent, joint undertaking, sale or lease of property and loan. All right, we went through all of that. That's all in the book. I think that's probably that chapter, the accounting chapter, and maybe the statistics chapter are the ones that are most likely to be of real use to you, assuming you don't end up practicing before Judge Posner, in which case the law and econ and the econ chapters might also be useful. Someday, I think I remember back when I was at Chicago, made the comment that, you know, you can say lots of things about different law schools, but the University of Chicago Law School is the only law school with its own circuit. Given that I think at that point three professors or ex-professors were federal appeals court judges in the same circuit. All right, so then our final chunk, which we've just been finishing, is accounting, where there were four things that we wanted you to understand. One of them was a balance sheet, one of them was a cash flow statement, one of them was an income statement, and the final one was the T accounts, which are actually used sort of transaction by transaction to take account of each. T account shows every transaction twice, once on the left side, once on the right side, and it does that ultimately either because a gain balances a loss, as when we sell something, get some money, and reduce inventory, or alternatively, because a gain without a loss increases income and eventually equity, and a loss without a gain decreases income and eventually equity. That's the basic logic of it. The fundamental equation is that, one thing you ought to know, I think, is the fundamental equation is assets equal liabilities plus equity. You can think of that as assets minus liabilities equals equity. That's the most intuitive way to me. But you could also think of it as saying everything that belongs to the firm belongs to somebody. Who does it belong to? Either the creditors or the owners. All right, that's a different way of thinking about the same thing. People talk about losing their houses when they have a foreclosure, and then there's the line on the other side, it's not my house, it's the bank's house, until I pay off the loan. Well, that's the liabilities part of it. So that's the fundamental equation, and that's, in a sense, what we get double entry bookkeeping out of, because that says, in order to keep this equation true, anytime we decrease assets, we have to decrease either liabilities, equities, or some combination, anytime we increase assets and so forth. All right, that's where your double entry bookkeeping is basically just the arithmetic of making that statement stay true. Then there are some notable complications to how you do accounting, and one of them is what time period do you really want to allocate your income and expenses to. That anytime there's a transaction, you're going to want to have a T account, but the T account can sometimes be, in effect, a way of pushing the income or the expense into a later period. So that if the T account shows that you sold something, that you spent some money on getting prepaid expenses for next year's, you paying your rent in advance or something, that lets you have the actual costs show up next year on your income statement, which is when it ought to show up. So what you try to do is, so far as possible, manipulate it so that a cost and the associated benefit show up in the same year, and therefore you can see what the net is. All right, that's the basic logic of it. Second issue with accounting, which we largely started with, is that there are a variety of simplifications built into accounting rules which are really designed to reduce the influence of judgment calls, to make it more nearly an unambiguous mechanical process rather than, well, my opinion is this land is worth so much at the moment, so put it in at that amount. So you have a set of rules. They are sometimes wrong, but at least they are, hopefully, they're designed to be fairly clear. Everything goes in at a purchase price. All probabilities are one or zero and so forth. All right. Questions? Yes?
I have a really quick question. Last, I think it was last class, there would be math below someone buying $1,000. It's about a bronze. Is it going over
that again? Sure. You
buy a truck which you expect to last for 5 years.
Right.
So what happens? What happens on the cash side? $10,000 on the right side. What happens to assets? You have a $10,000 asset. However, if you bought it at the beginning of the year, we're getting a fifth of the use of the truck this year. So that means we have $2,000 over here. That's the depreciation on the truck for 1 year. And over here, we've got expenses. And one of the expenses of my business was $2,000 for a year's use of my truck. Does that make sense?
So when you close out the account, though, that was the only transaction. It would show
a $2,000 expense, but of course that's right, because if you haven't used that truck to make some money, you've just lost $2,000 more or less. Alright.
Questions? No questions? I believe I've currently got the recordings and whiteboards for this class up to date as of the end of last week. I was doing that yesterday, so if you want to review anything that ought to be there, I will photograph these when we're finished. So, yeah.
Can you do the same for, I think there's a situation where you get costs for the cost.
You could imagine that. That's perfectly legitimate. Sure.
Suppose that we now have that what we're doing is we're renting for 5 years, and the way this particular in fact, really the same thing. You could imagine that we say, all right, it's too much trouble to pay you each year. The landlord is in Timbuktu, so we're going to give the landlord a $10,000 check this year. And that $10,000 check is going to take 5 years rent of the land. All right, well, we would then say we have a $10,000 asset. And what's the asset? It's prepaid expenses, is I think what that one is called. It's a $10,000 asset. All right, I'm doing this one in orange just to separate it. And of that $10,000, $2,000 got used up this year because we actually used the property we rented for a year this year. And that, again, is a $2,000 expense for this year.
What about inventory that you invest in now for future?
If you buy inventory, let's get a third color.
Yes.
We buy $10,000 of inventory, and we now have one of our assets is inventory, $10,000. And during the year, we sell some of that. So each time we sell it, the inventory goes down by, say, $3,000 just to be different, and cash goes up by some suitable. All right.
Happy? Great. All right. Study hard.
I have not written an exam yet. I try never to write it until after the last class, so I won't give away anything. Can't give away stuff I don't know.
Good principle of security. Think of it as the need to know a principle applied for one person over time.
You don't think you can give away something you don't know?
I can't give away information I don't have, yes.
Okay.
What were you thinking of that?
I suppose you're right. But the information that you are going to have isn't going to come from nowhere.
Yes, but I've been giving that away for all semester, haven't I?
Yes.
It is sort of neat realizing how long my telephone I have in my pocket, a voice recorder and camera.
What is
that?
Yeah.
It's an Android phone. It's a smartphone. Probably the normal smartphone. I expect it to work an iPhone or a Windows 7 or something else. It would still be true. Take this one again. See that I'm going to use a couple of things. What? I was working on, I started working on some verses which has to do with the Jesuits.
Right.
Having to do with the Jesuits and the building. I'll give you the beginning of it. I haven't figured out where to go with this. I was thinking about this when I was driving over here. That you realize that the naming pattern of the buildings around the law school is designed to confuse us. Here we are. The Jesuits through history are famous for their subtlety, a fact that offers subtle clues to names intended to confuse. Our classroom building we must call Bannon. But in Bergen Hall, we have our offices and lunch at Benson, which supports my hunch. And then every theory what a clever thing you're trying to teach us by making that thing find the thing with the name, all of which start with B and end with N. You never notice that you are less easily confused than I am. Yeah. Finding the right place is easy. Telling people the right place is hard.
Yeah,
that requires you remember the name of it. Is it Bergen, Bannon, or Benson? It's one of those things.
Yeah.
So, would the class be better with PowerPoint or worse? Or worse?
I've actually been looking at the PowerPoints online, and I like that I can look at the PowerPoints online and it's not distracting here. You do enough board work, at least for me, where I feel comfortable to look at something.
All right.
Talking.
Well, then I may want to keep doing that then, right, at PowerPoints.
As long as I don't need any new classes. If you get new classes, I have to make a new set of PowerPoints. I got them for the Apex case. I looked up my PowerPoints to find out, because I didn't remember what I'd done with it last time, and it wasn't on my notes for the lecture for some reason. The PowerPoint had it. The PowerPoint was actually more fun because I don't remember how I put it. The last slide after playing the Apex is up about, head for the exit, do not delay.
Yeah. I think the nice thing is when you talk about, when we look at the numbers, it's one thing to understand it, it's another thing to actually write it out in an answer or explain it on paper.
Yes.
And the PowerPoints provide that to you as a student.
Yeah. Yeah, my prejudice is in a sense that if you can't do problems, you may be fooling yourself and think you understand it. Somewhere there's one, you know what Feynman was, physicist?
No.
He was a very famous, sort of very brilliant, weird physicist, no longer alive. And there's a couple of books which are sort of his accounts of various things, but told to somebody younger. And one of them involves visiting somewhere in South America and concluding that none of the physics graduates are doing any business. That they could talk about physics, but they couldn't do any physics. That it was sort of, coming out of, I guess, you think of sort of an academic culture where the high status thing is being able to say profound things, not being able to build stuff. And my nearest equivalent to that, which isn't really the same, was my first published article in economics, which was a theory of the size and shape of nations. I may tell the story if I don't remember, but basically, when I originally submitted my journal,
But yeah, I feel like it's not. I think a core problem is on a digital standpoint, we need to get any charity in defense. I'm just going to kind of check off that. Yeah. I was going to take that a little further, I guess. So it's only 10 pages, right? And it would only have to be 10 pages. Right.
I don't know what I'm going to do. I was thinking about doing something on how to close one of the
classes. Oh, yeah. You should totally do that.
But I don't know what.
Yeah. Could you specify it for like movies or TV?
Well, I think there are different tools. I know I'm going to be like, well, there are no movies. There are certain laws for TV, but it really wants to be broadcast. So there's such a big gray area. So that's how big of a question.
Yeah. And we can talk about TV.
track this whole story. You know, some people have stories that are so lengthy that you can't catch us.
And that constrains enough so that he's also.
Did you do it from all that? Did you? Yeah. So he did some stuff in England.
Yeah. He tried to do the same thing in England. They also said, so you can't work basically anymore on anything.
Some people are told.
Thank you.
Okay, let's rock and roll. Hope everyone had a nice 3-day weekend. If we have not, if you are writing a paper and we have not talked about it in the last 2 weeks or so, could you give me a status report when you get a moment and just let me know how it's going, making sure that things are proceeding? As you can tell for the newer papers, I'm not a developer, so let's use this as a friendly opportunity to check in with you. And just a reminder, I would love your feedback on the chapters. Obviously, when we did a chapter before, it's such a monster, it's overwhelming. But I hope the remaining chapters are manageable enough to provide some feedback. So I'll just remember to set that again. Today we're going to finish our discussion about some of the practice issues that we were dealing with. We'll get to talking about some of the class action e-learning materials. We'll talk a little bit about surveys, and then we'll talk about remedies. I don't have any fun commercials to show you today, so I apologize. Today we just have a bunch of rules to discuss, so sorry about that. But I think next week we'll have some fun commercials. I'll decide which ones we want to do, but we'll have some good ones next week. Okay, class action lawsuits. So remember, we're talking about class action lawsuits not because they're unique to advertising law, but because they're such an integral part of the advertising law landscape. If you recall, the general rule is whether you can establish a class is generally determinative about whether there will be a legal action. Most of the time, individual complaints are not enough to warrant proceeding in court. And so either the claims are consolidated into a class or they are effectively irrelevant. So class actions are a big part of thinking about your risk. They're a big part of thinking about whether it's a plaintiff you're going to win. And as I said, if you actually can form a class and get the class approved, usually that's going to mean a check for the plaintiffs. Even if their claim is ultimately not meritorious, most of the time the risk goes up so substantially once the class is formed that the defendants will decide, let's see if we can buy off the risk rather than see it to its logical conclusion. So effectively, class actions become the determinant of cash. Class forms, cash is likely to be forthcoming. No class, if the defendant can bust a class before it forms or prevent it from forming, then the plaintiffs get nothing. So you recall that we have a federal statute that governs class action lawsuits and where they can be heard. Class action lawsuits can be removed to federal court when there's $5 million plus at issue and there's members from two or more states. Unless we have enough people all in the same state, then we're going to say it's really a single state lawsuit. And so, as a practical matter, many of the advertising lawsuits that we see end up being removed to federal court. Defendants almost always would prefer federal court over state court. How does someone become a state court judge? Do you know how? Well, okay, but how do you win? You're tough on crime, right? That's the way to become a state court judge. You're tough on crime. So a lot of the judges are keyed up for the criminal cases. They don't really know much about advertising law. Federal judges by the time of appointment, by the president. So it's just a different type of person who becomes a federal judge. Most time, if you're a defendant, you'd rather have this case in federal court. And so you'll see, in fact, the defendants trying to stretch these limits as much as possible to get it into federal court because they would much rather be there. So the first question is, which courts are going to be heard in? When we're in federal court, you recall there were four elements to class certification. There's numerosity, that you couldn't join all the participants in a single lawsuit through normal joinder procedures, that the class is the better way to get the claims consolidated. The commonality, that there's questions of law or fact that are common to the class. Then we have two questions about the specific named representatives of the class. Is their claims typical, and are they going to be adequate representatives?
And then we have another, you have to do something else above and beyond those four elements. Typically, when we're dealing with advertising law, in the case of this 23b3, which talks about predominance, that the questions of fact law you already said are common, but they predominate over any questions that apply to individual members. So these are really the key questions of the lawsuit, and then superiority, which is this is the best way to resolve the claim. These elements are subject to plenty of debate among the parties. In many cases, individual plaintiffs might have very different circumstances. They might be in different states, and therefore, depending on what claims are bringing, their legal rights might be different. They might be different in terms of the ways in which they expected the products to work, the reliance piece, what they expected to get from the purchase that they made. And then we might have differences about the remedies or the injuries that they suffered. How do we measure how this product failed to measure up? It might be very different for the individual plaintiff. So establishing the questions about this commonality and this predominance is actually one of the key questions in a class action case. It depends a lot on exactly what claims are alleged to be wrong. And then how you trace that to whatever harms are alleged to have been suffered. Okay. This is only with respect to federal court. Now, state courts also enable you to have class actions. And in fact, it's fairly common nowadays. The typical thing I see is that you have a federal claim for a federal class action claim for all nationwide. And then you'll have a specific state class named as part of the complaint as well. So if you file here in California, you'll say, class number one is all people who purchase this product nationwide. Class number two is all people who purchase products in California. And you'll have those in parallel. The idea is if you get knocked out of your nationwide class, you still got your state class to work with. And that might be enough to still be sizable. Remember, here in California, we're roughly 10% of the nation's economy and population. You can get 10% of the payoff just if you have a California class. So having a California class is very common, along with trying to get the national class. So we also have to worry about state laws and state class actions as well. Now, here in California, we've had some limits applied to our legal doctrine. We talked about our unfair competition laws. You remember that these are some of the squishy laws that we have on a state-by-state basis. And we passed the Proposition 64, which tried to limit the application of our unfair competition and fair advertising laws. We have two key cases that have tried to interpret how Prop 64 overlays in a way that is relevant to class action formation. So first of all, we have Tobacco 2, which says that when we're worried about standing, who has the standing to bring the claim, we're only going to worry about the class representatives. We don't have to show that every single person who would be a member of the class would have the requisite standing. This solves a bunch of problems that you might have because, as I said, every buyer might be in a different position. You might have all kinds of debates over whether the buyer met the requirements for standing. Here, that showing the class has standing, the class representative has standing, and we won't worry about anyone else. Case also says that if you're suing based on a misrepresentation, you're going to have to show that there was actual reliance on that misrepresentation. It's not enough to show there was a misrepresentation. It shows that was part of the decision-making process on the part of the buyer. This obviously is a substantial bite. Plaintiffs have difficult times showing actual reliance. They could say, I thought that ad was really interesting. They got to take it the next step and say, this was part of my decision-making process. Okay, the book referenced the Kwikset case. So, as typical for rapidly evolving legal areas, the description about in the book about the Kwikset case is already mooted. We had a California Supreme Court case come out in January, opinion come out in that case in January. And Prop 64 used some funny language. It talks about spending money as part of the requirements of standing. And what this says, the way I'm reading it, and Travis might disagree with it, but the way I read it, is that, here, remember, we're looking for reliance. As here the court says, well, how did reliance live? The plans were, quote, deceived by a product's label into spending money to purchase the product and have would not have purchased it otherwise. Notice what this says by inference. Again, this is these laws are so complicated, sometimes you have to read the inference to realize it. What this says is you don't have to show any other harm here in order to show the actual reliance. All you have to do is say, I was misled into buying the product. That's all you got to say. And I would have purchased otherwise. In other words, if you could say, look, you got exactly what you bargained for as a total package. You weren't really hurting any part of the process. We're still going to have this. We're still going to meet the standard for reliance. This particular case, as you recall, involved a padlock. Is that the right terminology? Padlock. And it was advertised as made in the United States. And there was some small percentage of the materials that were not made in the United States. They should not have said what they said. Okay, so the starting point is, we had a misrepresentation. But how were the buyers harmed to that problem? What exactly went wrong when a small percentage of their padlock was not accurately labeled? They might have very well paid market price for that good. In other words, they might not have been able to find any better option for cheaper price, even if they said, I'm only going to buy the good that was an issue. So what's the problem here, right? And the court says, well, we're not going to get into that quick. All you got to show me is that made in the USA was the thing that you were looking for, and you chose to buy it on that basis. You can make that argument. We're fine for purposes of Prop 64 and it's overlay on top of these laws. So, what this does is, in theory, it expands the universe of class action lawsuits that are going to succeed because it makes the standard a little bit lighter. We're still wrestling with the overlay of Prop 64 to the unfair competition law. This is a perennial in the courts because our statutory drafting is so poor that it's impossible to really understand what the law does. So I don't think this is the end of the story. But this is where we stand today. In terms of forming your California class, you got to show your class representative standing. You got to show actual reliance. But you can show actual reliance and we can simply argue that it was the basis of the decision making, even if you don't otherwise have any way of showing that you would purchase something else. We did spend a lot of time talking about made in the USA or other types of labels like that. There's a whole body of case law about what made in the USA means or other types of source identifications, and let's just acknowledge they exist, and we're not going to get into them with each other. I was going to move on to talk about consumer surveys, but before I do that, any thoughts or questions about class action lawsuits and some of the standards for when you can be subject to a class? All right, let's turn to surveys here. Now, recall that surveys are one of the requirements if you are working on an implied representation. So remember, if you have an actual misrepresentation, if you have a misrepresentation, you're going to, we'll take it on its face, but when it's an implied statement, then we have to show what did the consumers understand about the implied message. Do they understand that message? And consumer surveys are the typical way that they would come up. Consumer surveys can also be useful for things like measuring damages. You might need to show what consumers would have done in the field. There's a couple other places where consumer surveys come up. For those who are interested in trademark law, we also use consumer surveys extensively in trademark law. for figuring out whether consumers likely be confused by a particular trademark. And as Rebecca mentioned in the book, in fact, in many cases, the consumer survey and legal doctrines between trademark law and false advertising law are basically the same. The courts have merged the legal standards. So there's a lot of overlay between them. You're not going to believe this, but when I was looking through Rebecca's notes, she spends a whole week on consumer surveys. I have four slides, so we'll probably spend 20 minutes of me talking and maybe a little bit of time in discussion here. There's a lot that could be said about surveys, but I'm guessing you would prefer to have 20 minutes than a week. Let's lay out some basic rules here about surveys. So let's just be clear. So there's a bunch of questions where we want to know what consumers are thinking. And so we're going to have a whole bunch of battles over that. Remember, these battles are going to come in where it's not just a negotiation between the person who hires or retains the survey expert and the judge. You got that side who's lobbing grenades left and right here. And so in order to get a survey in and have it actually do what you want to do, you got to navigate this huge gauntlet of challenges. Let's start with some of the basics. First of all, in order for a survey to be introduced, it has to be relevant. So we have to have a situation where, if you recall from Federal Rules of Evidence 403, its probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. You guys remember this rule. This is one of the basic rules of evidence. This is something that, in my world, I don't normally deal with evidentiary issues, but this is one that comes up even then. Okay, so we start with the first point. You've got to show probative value is greater than prejudice. And what happens in practice on this point is that the courts are going to let in the survey, but usually they're going to reduce its evidentiary weight. They're going to say, you know what, it's relevant, but there's all these reasons why we're not going to treat it as if it's gospel. It's a very typical outcome. Courts are very reluctant, frankly, to exclude surveys altogether and simply say, you know what, that's just such junk, I'm not going to tolerate it. But you're really fighting over how much credit. Is it getting 10% credit or 80% or 90% credit? It can make a huge difference to the outcome. Another standard here is whether or not the survey is reliable. This is 702. Some of you may be familiar with the Dauber case, the Supreme Court case. The 702 is basically an extension of. And here when we're dealing with these quasi-scientific surveys, we need to make sure that they're done properly. And so some of the things we look for is whether they're based on sufficient facts or evidence, the product of reliable principles and methods, and the principles and methods are applied appropriately to the facts.
How many of you take evidence? This is real meat and potatoes evidence stuff, right? We're not talking anything complicated here. If you haven't taken evidence, you will have your pleasure of getting exposed to these. Of all the classes I took in law school, I'm pretty sure evidence is the one I learned the least from. I was a transactional guy. I didn't care about evidence. And I took a pass on pass, so I didn't study. So I don't know much about that. So here's some basic filters that we apply. So you got the survey that you want to introduce to show a point that you're trying to argue. First, you got to get over the 403 barrier and argue that it's relevant. That's probably the relatively low barrier in the circumstances, right? And you got to get over the 702 barrier and show that it's in accordance with appropriate scientific principle. Okay, let's assume we can get through that. Now, let's turn to the harder questions in consumer surveys. I've been thinking about surveys and some of the dynamics here as part of preparing for this class. And I came up with two structural problems with consumer surveys. Why we have so much battles over a piece of paper. You understand what I mean by that. And problem number one is that most of the time,
products have multiple groups of consumers who purchase the same product, and they have different needs. It's not like there's a single monolithic, reasonable consumer that well describes the entire set of people who might be interested in purchasing them. In fact, usually you have this group of buyers, and this group of buyers, and this group of buyers, and then you have very different demographics or attributes. And typically, survey practice is trying to consolidate them down to a single exemplar customer. And that doesn't work, because you're trying to abstract away from all these heterogeneous buyers with their heterogeneous preferences and trying to make it into a single person. And so a lot of what we see in the survey practice ends up being friction because of this problem. This is an easily fixable problem. You could break down your buyers into multiple constituent parts, and then you could survey each of those groups. Remember, we'll come back to that when we talk about cost. Everything is available for the right price. But we might decide that's too expensive, but if we don't do that step and we try and abstract away the heterogeneous buyers, then we save some money, but we ultimately create a lot of friction about how to trust the survey as being accurate. The second is that the survey is basically asking, what did you think? How does this affect your thoughts in the marketplace? And you can ask people what they're thinking, and it's different from how they respond in the field. You guys have surely seen surveys like this. You say to people, I have a new product offering. Would you be willing to buy it for $1, for $5, for $10? And you can kind of build a reverse engineer demand curve by asking people that. You know how valuable those insights are, right? They're not. People will tell you what they'll be willing to do, but what they actually do in the field, how they actually allocate their dollars in the field, is far more accurate about what they're thinking and how they're feeling. So we have a problem here where we're trying to figure out, is there something going on with respect to marketplace activity? And we're trying to measure by asking people what they're thinking. It's a mismatch. You can't get the right information by asking people what they might do as opposed to what they might be thinking as opposed to what they would actually do. Okay. The reason why Rebecca spends an entire week on surveys is because she's, I think, interested in this basic question. What if we just got rid of the survey requirements altogether? Remember, for these implied representations, we're trying to figure out if consumers understand them. What if we just said, you know what, let the judge decide that. Or let the jury decide that. If there's a jury, get the surveys out of it. This is not as ridiculous as it might sound. Let's just slow down for a moment and talk about it from the standpoint of costs and benefits. Surveys are expensive. And as we already talked about, they're abstracts, right? They're not actually telling us everything we want to know. They're approximations for the things that we might want to know. And then what happens in practice is when the other side rips into that survey, it just gets shredded. So people spend a lot of money on surveys. And usually there's dueling surveys in these cases. The plaintiff and the defendant both get their own surveys together. And then they both rip them apart. And so you end up with a lot of money invested to get something that the end judge is saying, you know, this isn't really all that credible anymore. And so query if the survey process ends up getting what we want from a social outcome perspective. We're actually moving the ball forward on the questions that matter to us when we require a survey. I think that is an interesting policy question. I could see writing a paper about that. For your purposes, that's an intellectual curiosity, but it doesn't really change what you do. In the field, you're going to go get a survey. And then, when your opponent gets a survey, you're going to go hire your expert to rip it apart. Kind of how the game goes. You can come up with a way of improving upon that. I encourage you to do so, because your survey will not survive the other side's expert ripping it apart. Okay, let's talk about how you get a good survey together. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to lay out some of the key attributes of a survey that might actually survive being shredded. So here's some of the things that you need to do when you're thinking about doing a survey. First, you need to define the universe of people that you're serving. The ultimate asset test is prospective purchasers of defendants' goods. That's who you're trying to survey. Now, figuring out who those are goes back to the point I just made. There might be multiple groups. So remember, for example, the Gillette case. There was the problem about male versus female. And so there, most of the buyers were male, but there was a minority of buyers who were female buying for their gun. And so we have a problem there. What do you do? Most of the buyers, the typical person is going to be a male, but there's this sub-community of females who are also key decision makers here. How can you survive that? You could do two surveys. We're going to do survey number one, just guys. Survey number two, just women. And then we'll compare the results that we get. That would be a way around that problem. As you can see, though, because of the heterogeneity of the buyer populations, defining your universe is the first point of failure a lot of times. You cannot accurately define your population in a way that isn't subject to criticism, given the fact that you have heterogeneous buyers. Okay, next, you're going to have to set up your sample. So you're not going to survey every prospective purchaser. That's not feasible. So you're going to try and do approximations of your universe. And there's a bunch of ways that you do that. So the book talked about mall intercepts. Has anyone ever done a mall intercept survey? Yeah? Tell me about your survey.
It's actually pretty
So describe your case, sir. Where were you?
I was at a valley there.
Okay.
There were like maybe 20 people with clipboards.
20 people with clipboards?
Yeah.
That's a lot of people, isn't it?
Yeah. I can't remember what it was about, but and then they actually had a small little like kind of tent thing set up, like kind of little rooms like buddy booth. So I guess you could be away from other people, but you could completely hear what the person actually is saying. So they just were approaching a lot of people. It was like a town range, black, without a shirt. It was mostly a dress off. And it stopped from their guys. And they just said, hey, you know, I'm doing a survey, I'd like to participate. Can you be able to be like,
how much?
It was like $3 or $5.
$3 or $5. Okay.
Certificate
for 10 minutes, right? So do the math, right? That would be if it's $3, that was $18 an hour, or $5 would be $30 an hour.
Yeah. So they didn't. They asked me mostly open-ended questions. It was more. It was on slogans. It wasn't. We started out with really general slogans, and then we just kind of asked people what they thought about it. And then they kept saying, if there were any questions, kind of how the book described it. And then they kept getting more specific, and so they felt like they had really close to the actual slogan, and the actual slogan and asked us what it made me think about, what it was getting at, maybe my ideas.
Would you do it again?
Wasn't that bad, actually. So, I mean, like, some of the ones, I mean, one of the key points was that they just said was keep it quick. So, I mean, it was only 10 minutes. Like, so maybe go in, maybe 20 minutes on those. But, they just said, okay, the questions kind of got to the point after a while. That was
a little too abstract.
Yeah. Because I wasn't sure if they were the really driving for anything.
So you're trying to screw up the survey?
No, I wasn't trying to screw it up. I just wasn't sure how far I could go on the thought process and how far I could go.
So obviously everyone has different habits. I go into malls maybe once a year, and it's torture for me. So anything that keeps me longer there is clearly habit. So you're going to have some biases built into the notion of surveying at the mall. You obviously are only reaching people who go to malls, and that assumes a whole bunch of people right off the bat. Now, malls are the logical place to do it because you're looking for, remember, prospective purchasers. So you're looking for shoppers, right? You don't want to go to the park and ask people because they're not demonstrating shoppers. So the mall solves one problem. You get the demonstration that people are shoppers, and it creates a bunch of new ones, which is you skew the population to the people who are likely to be in malls, and even if you weed out to like the male 18 to 30, usually you're going to run into additional problems getting the right mix of people from that. So people will love to do things like internet surveys. They solve a problem, right? Now you don't have to wait for people to randomly walk into a mall. You can get access to the whole population once again. Internet surveys introduce us a whole new set of biases and a whole new set of problems as well about things that we'll talk about in a moment about actually, you know, is that the right kind of environment? Is it a shopping environment and one that's analogizable to the things that you're interested in? So, so no matter what, you've got, no matter where you do your sampling, you're going to introduce some bias into the system or some errors into the system that you need to correct for. Now, as we talked about, what you'll do is you'll have quotas. You'll say, I'm looking for a certain numbers of people who meet these demographics, and you'll go into your quotas. You can have multiple quotas, as I said. You could have the, you know, I'm going to have the 18 to 30-year-old male, these are our target audience for this particular shaver, and I'm also going to have another one for the 18 to 30-year-old female, they're also a target audience, and we'll have quotas for both. You can do that, again, you're going to have to do more work to get those people. And I don't know how many of you have taken a class in statistics somewhere along the way? Okay, good. If you haven't taken a class in statistics and you're going to do anything involving complex litigation, you should strongly consider taking a class like that. Professor Friedman, I can't remember if it's before or after this class, one of his classes he teaches is Analytical Methods for Lawyers, which includes stuff like surveys. That's a good class to have when you're dealing with stuff like this because you need to know how you manage your survey results, how you evaluate the data. So one thing is, the larger your sample size, the smaller your confidence interval. The book talked a little about what that meant. Basically, it meant that if you're trying to estimate the probability that you're in the right range of numbers, the smaller your sample size, the bigger your range is. The more people you put into your data set, the more likely you think that the sample is reflective of the universe at large. And so you can always reduce your confidence interval, which is the range of possible statistics based on the data that you got, but only by getting bigger samples, which means more money. Going back again to the mole intercept, notice that the book also talks about usually you would not do it in single geographies. You would do it multiple geographies instead of eliminating the risk of geographic bias. And so, again, the more that you do to try to get an accurate depiction of what's going on in people's minds, the more that it's going to cost you. And so, the bigger sample size, you know, it's kind of like one of the things. How big is the right sample size? Well, the biggest you can afford. There's no single answer to that because everything you do spend money at the problem will make your answer more precise. You saw that there was a number of ways to handle sampling issues. You can do control groups. So you're not only going to survey based on the ad in question, you're also going to run other ads through the same process to try and see how people respond to this as well, and then you can compare the data between them. You also might do things like pilot studies, where you do some tests of what the data is going to be before you do the full test. A, you can identify if your survey is doing something goofy, and B, you might say, you know what, we've got trouble here. That might be useful limited data that will give us a preview of what's going on. So there's a bunch of things you could do in terms of how you manage the people you actually sample to try and get more accuracy or to reduce your cost remember, in the end, in almost all cases, everything translates to bigger bucks. Okay, the next thing that goes into the proper elements of a survey design is the questions need to be clear and they cannot be leading. So as Mr. Manifestor said, typically you'll start out with open-ended questions, broad things that let people explain what's on their mind without channeling them, and then you'll lead to closed-end questions where you'll start to really drill down on the specific things that you're looking for. The problem with open-ended questions is that they're harder to code accurately. You can't, you're going to introduce a potential error into the system when you take what people answer and try and fit it into some kind of numerical format. You want to turn it into things you can punch numbers on. So the open-ended questions are hard to code. The closed-ended questions are more likely to be leading questions in the sense they're more likely to communicate to the person that you're surveying what you're looking for. And as a result, that can introduce error to the system as well. As a matter of fact, as you said, it sounded like if they would have just told you what they were looking for, you would have been happy to say it to move the process along.
Yeah.
but even if not, you should recognize that the surveying process educates the consumer as they're going along. Consumers are smart. They're thinking about what you're, why you're asking these questions and evaluating that, so that the questions that follow, that every subsequent question has been informed by the previous sets of questions, and that can introduce error as you go along in the process. There's also things like order bias. Answers are not distributed randomly among the set of answers. People pick the first written option, they pick the last oral option more heavily than the others. So it's just a natural human instinct. You go with the first written one or the last oral one. So what you have to do is, if you want to eliminate the order bias problem, you need to rejigger the survey so that you can mix it up. Ideally, you have a large enough population where you rotate each of the questions through and make them the first on the appropriate number, one quarter, if you've got four answers or whatever it is. You rotate them through so that you get you eliminate that in the ultimate results. Again, you can solve this problem with more money. And then you also want to replicate as much as possible marketplace conditions. So you saw there was all the debate about, do you let people linger looking at the ads, or do you show it to them and then take it away from them? Or do you let people pick up the product and inspect it, or not? And each of those has its pros and cons in terms of replicating marketplace experiences. On the one hand, people like to inspect things. They like to look around at it. On the other hand, that's not the way typical buyers work. Typically, they take a in the information and they make a decision. Or if it's a TV ad, they don't go and re-TiVo it, you know, go back and rewind on TiVo to watch it a second time. The only reason why they would choose to watch it a second time is because they're actually trying to evaluate the questions that you're asking. So no, they're no longer acting like a normal buyer in the marketplace. They're doing something extra to try and inform their answers. The next element of a survey design is that you're going to want somebody who's qualified to be a surveyor, and they're going to follow the proper procedures and methodologies. What that means is you're going to hire somebody who does surveys. Usually you're going to hire somebody who's done a lot of them. So it's one of these things where the rich get richer. Someone who's done 100 surveys is more valuable than someone who's doing it first. And normally you as a litigant would choose the latter, even at a price premium. And you can do work to figure out whose surveys survive. I mean, you know, there's ways of actually going and saying, okay, show me what surveys you did and show me how well they fared in court. I mean, you can see how the judges respond to your particular survey expert. So, you know, the people you're likely to evaluate have a track record. You should take a look at it as part of deciding whether it's the right person for you. Okay, the next step is that you want to accurately report the data. And I mentioned this is things like how you code it. You also want to analyze it via acceptable, accepted statistical principles. Your expert should take care of this, no problem. And the whole process is supposed to be objective in the sense that, and I didn't like to use the term double blind, but it's fine for our purposes now. The server should know the survey sponsor. It should know the hypothesis you're trying to prove. They should be completely in the dark about what you're trying to test for and who you're testing for as part of the process. The other thing that fits under this heading is you generally, your survey expert should be independent enough from you that it's not like you're a puppet master pulling on the string. So part of this is you hire a survey expert, you let them do their thing, you don't unduly interfere with it, and then they should know how to mask their tracks so that people can't figure out. Did you ever figure out who the survey was for? Then that was properly done, right? I go back to the question that I asked on the previous slide. Is the game worth the candle? You can see all the different ways that the approximations that are involved in designing surveys lead to distortions in the ultimate analysis. And all that comes at significant cost. I'm sorry, I don't know what exact survey expert is. I'm sure it's easily over 100 grand. My guess is that to do a large scale survey would be more like $250,000. Do we get good value from that? These are just some of the ways that you can trash the survey. Questions or comments on survey design? When you're in the field, it's your responsibility to make sure you got the right expert who's going to guide you through this process. And you're going to pay them for that expertise. And two, you need to ask them tough questions to make sure that they're not doing anything rudimentary that's dumb. If you think it's dumb, then they either need to explain to you why you're wrong or they need to fix it. So that's your job. Isn't to know all the rules of statistics, but it's to apply that sanity test on what your expert's approaching to, make sure they're not doing something that's going to be an easy way of knocking out the survey. Yes, ma'am. Problem with scientific evidence generally that there's always this dilemma that judges face between truly rigorous scientific work being done that's designed to facilitate the truth and quackery, and the whole idea behind things like Rule 702 and the Dahmer standard was let's get rid of the quackery that's coming in as evidence that's being presented as a pseudo scientific approach that's designed just to baffle judges. They can't figure out what's true or not. Let's try to get rid of that evidence altogether. But you're absolutely right. In the end, all we do is the judge's intuition moves to whether or not they're going to admit the survey and how much weight they're going to give to it. So, in theory, it is helping the process, but it's just relocating that intuition. Yeah. It's a good question. I don't have a good answer for you about that. I would think that this is the kind of thing that would be done on the scale of weeks, that it could very well be months. It could not be days. There's no way for you to do it. But you would typically have the luxury of time, unless you're seeking injunctive relief, in which one you have to go in and you have to make your case based on whatever evidence you could do with Marshall. We're going to have, I think I brokered the deal, we're going to have a guy come in from Clorox who does their advertising review, and we can ask him that question. And in particular, I'm curious how much, even if they're not retaining experts to do the surveys, how much they're basically talking with their scientists who are constantly doing tests anyway. You know what I'm saying? I mean, when I had my pre-call with him, He was telling me about all the ways in which he works with scientists. Anyway, they're always testing stuff. They're always running through this. So you might have some evidence already in-house. It's not going to be industrial grade for evidentiary purposes. But you might have some stuff to work with already. But when you're going to have to do the big this type of survey, we can ask for how long it takes. But my guess is it's measured in weeks.
Yeah, I see that. Because there's definitely a cost as well having to
Yes, yes. And for those who took the IP survey class with me, remember we talked about that, how you could tie up engineers in discovery. Remember we talked about that in the Rockwell case, for example, that discovery in these cases is a good way to mess up your opponent. And so depending on how you do it, that is a cost of the process. Other comments or questions on survey design?
We have the Mead Johnson versus Abbott case here involving Similac.
I don't know what you guys think of that trademark. It doesn't work for me. Something not really working for me. I feel like a little bear, though. I think he's cute. But you saw the mountains of litigation generated over the phrase here, first choice of doctors. So we're interested in this whole thing. This is the only visual thing I got for you. I don't have any TV commercials today. Let's look at this little blue flag here. First choice of doctors. So we have some implicit claims that come from the statement first choice of doctors. One implicit claim that we can draw from that is the majority of doctors choose Similac over the competitors. Right? The first part of first choice of doctors. And then the other implicit claim is that the doctors made this choice based on their professional judgment about product quality. That in their medical opinion, this product is better than that product. That may seem obvious, but doctors might recommend products for all kinds of reasons. They might recommend it because it's a better value. It's not the best product, but it's a better value. Or it might be because they are bought off. You guys are familiar with pharmaceutical marketing. It is a big business. Doctors are influencers, and they are besieged by companies that want them to recommend their products because the recommendation from a doctor is highly impactful on its customers and can move lots of product. So it might be that doctors do recommend Similac over others, but not because they've chosen it as medically superior, but because they've been bought off. Similac takes them to the resort in the Caribbean, and FML takes them to the Torino. Okay, so we're working on this first choice of doctors, and we're trying to figure out what that means, and we're working on these two implicit claims that draw from that. So we're interested in these two claims and whether or not they're supportable. Let's take a look at the substantiation that we've got. The evidence is overwhelming that many doctors have no preference between Similac and its competitor, Enfamil. They like them both. This is a good problem, guys, right? It's better than saying there's no good products in the marketplace. Both of them, many guys are saying they're both good. We also have evidence that among the doctors who have a preference, doctors recommend Similac to Enfamil by roughly 2-1. And we have a bunch of surveys that try to evidence this, including we've got something where we've got some evidence that 25 to 48% of doctors rank Similac first in comparison to 10 to 40% of doctors ranked Enfamil first. Do you forget what the court said? Do you think Similac is allowed to make a claim first choice of doctors? I'll take some hands. Yes, ma'am.
I think it is.
you only look at doctors who actually make the choice. So you're not looking at doctors who have no preference, because they're not making any choice. And looking at doctors with preference, so you have, is actually their first choice.
So this is a true statement. It's true in all four.
Well, say it's true about the purchaser. I wouldn't really take it seriously. So when I read it, I thought, well, if I sell it, I would think that there might be maybe a little group of doctors, or maybe some. So it's just too general.
So as a consumer, you would put it in what we might call puffery.
It's a puffery, exactly. Uh-huh. That's what I thought when I read the page.
So you weren't interested in the factual representation. You thought this isn't really a factual statement at all. It was remember the definition of puffery was overly laudatory statements that no one really believes. You put yourself in that category. Okay.
All right. I wouldn't believe that they have the right to say this. The false choice of doctors that 60% of doctors or whatever don't have a choice. I think it's also implying that doctors make a choice between the two products and that this is the one they choose. So because only 48% of them make the choice, then I don't see that as being a false choice of doctors.
Well, these statistics are a little bit hard to parse. And I got these out of the appellate opinion. I didn't go back and take a look and see how they all sit next to each other. One way of reading this is that in one survey, the maximum 48% said Similac, 40% said Enfamil, and 12% said nothing. Or another way to read this is 25% said Similac, 10% said Enfamil, and 65% said nothing. Or it could be some other mixture. So the data is a little bit hard to put together.
Well, either way, in none of those surveys, it was a 51% of doctors think Similac is the best choice.
That's true. We do not have a majority here. The best we have is a plurality of doctors voting in favor of Similac. Right? So this is what we're debating over here. Majority versus plurality. Right? I mean, that's the issue, in a sense. So
I think the problem with doctor-based claims, medical, professional-based claims, are that you assume when you get advice from a doctor, this is my first choice, that they're considering the whole range of options available to you, such as breastfeeding, not using formula, using this formula, using that formula, some other new treatment that's just come out. So the statement, first choice of doctors, is as if the doctor is advising you, and this is clearly false.
Of course, he's
not the first. If you went to a doctor and said, what should I give my baby? He would not go, Similac. He would go, of course, first you should breastfeed. Mm-hmm. If you can't, for some reason, then there are different types of formulas. The best formula for my medical opinion is X.
So it could say, first choice of doctors after breastfeeding. You'd be okay with that claim?
Well, and then you get into all this stuff about the surveys. Yeah. I just don't think doctors should just make claims for it. Or companies should be able to use doctors to find
potential existing conditions. I'm sorry, can you expand on that a little bit? So you're taking a pretty hard line, it sounds like, which is no one should be able to put on their product that doctors like this or not, because that's inherently misleading.
Absolutely. No doctor, no medical coach, no, your doctor said this toothpaste is better than that toothpaste. I think it's completely misleading.
Okay.
And it turns medicine into a
I'm sorry, I do need to remind you, here in the U.S., it is a for-profit enterprise, and it is
I'm sure you know, in Europe, all pharmaceutical advertising is illegal. In Britain, any use of doctors to advertise anything is illegal. For this exact reason. I mean, and you know what these guys have done in Africa. Formulating. I mean, they're just, some of the stuff that is in these cases.
Sounds like you would condemn both.
Living. Well, and I've been going to, obstetricians and stuff that my wife's pregnant, and they all go up, one or the other under the desk. Here, have some.
Yeah, all right. Have you tried any of them? Have you just done a taste test?
The natural is far superior.
Other comments or questions about, other perspectives on the legitimacy of this claim, first choice of doctors, and whether it was properly substantiated? health-related claims are a problem, categorically, and we are more sensitive about them, generally. And you can see that in the cases that we've seen. We'll see more of those cases to come. Health-related claims are a problem. And I guess I'm just going to share my perspective. When I read this, I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. First choice of doctors based on the plurality is inherently misleading. They are totally preying on, this is exactly what an implied falsity is. They did not make the claim that they are majority, so the statement is literally true, but everyone's going to read it as if they have a majority vote among doctors. And they don't. I mean, this seems like such an easy case of exactly why we regulate implied claims at all. You saw that district court thought it was an easy case. I can't even figure out what the appellate court said. I'm not going to try to parse it through. So for me, this was an easy case. But I would side with the district court on this one. There really wasn't much to say. Did you guys see the references to how much they've been working to establish all the different ways of points of differentiation here through scientific research, trying to show this really is better than that one, or these doctors like it more than the other? I mean, this is an area where so much money is being wasted, not on actually improving the product, but on just trying to find any claim that they could substantiate well enough to advance it. Do you think that the first choice of doctors claim is effective? We had one vote that it was puffery and was disregarded. Do you guys think it's effective?
Yes, correct. The blue ribbon helps too, I think. It makes it seem like it's like blue ribbon award. You know, someone said that this is the best.
I think maybe my perspective is different from others. Whenever you are buying for a child, you don't really believe anything you see. So you want to do better than this more perfect. With the first set of doctors, you have to be skeptical. So maybe.
Can we explore that moment? Because mothers are a special case. And
yes.
Jim, you're assuming, you're talking about from mother's perspective. Dad's perspective, I would say it's the same thing. I don't know what percentage of buyers are moms versus dads. Who's dealing with the decision maker there? As parents, we're faced with a heightened sense of responsibility for our kids. Right? I mean, over and over again, we've seen ways in which people try to manipulate our devotion to try and make our lives better for our kids. Again, remember like the whole baby Einstein thing? You guys saw what happened with that one? Prime example, right? Who doesn't want their kid to be smart? They're selling them, you know, this is your way of giving your kid a turbocharged education. Put them in front of these videos. My kids love those videos, by the way. We are so susceptible to that. So one thing is, we're easy marks. Someone tells us, this is the best you can do for your kid. That is extremely impactful marketing. On the other hand, because it's our kids at issue, we are more likely to diligence claims than to just take them on their face. Is that where you're going with that?
Yeah, that's why I don't say I mentioned things like the first choice or the best. Or I just don't.
You say you don't, and I don't mean this to be disrespectful. I wonder if it still doesn't make a difference.
It's
subconsciously.
Well, actually, when I was choosing the formula, I looked at the label, at the content, to specifically compare the ingredients, and then I made my decision.
Mm-hmm. But I wonder if, you know, you can imagine when you're choosing, if you see what's the first choice of doctors and then you're evaluating the other options, you might have disregarded the thing, I'm not going to pick it on that basis, but you might become more skeptical of the other products. Do you see where I'm going with that?
I know, but...
Remember, we're an unusual group here, right? We're all highly educated lawyers in training, so our mental inquisition is going to be perhaps more than many of the buyers in the marketplace. So let's just acknowledge that. But I want you to query whether you would have actually... if even if you say, I know that's perfectly disregarded, if it didn't actually... affect some people who made that express choice that then disregard it.
And then specifically, both companies specifically stated that they must have said it happened somewhere, that they considered new mothers emotionally vulnerable, especially with the birth of them. So they must have done research to find out that their target audience was vulnerable and that they could make claims to change their buying choice.
Well, of course they're going to do that, right? You need to understand your customers. So you're going to do market research on what your customers want, and you're going to try to understand all the different levers that you can pull that will help make the decision. They're just on a product. It's no different than selling a car or selling a pen or whatever. It's all the same.
I don't know if it says C3 PRA, but doctor's ratification of brand choice relieves consumer of worrying about the choice.
So rather than saying, I made this choice for my kids, it's not my fault if I made the wrong choice. I'm sorry, I did mention this last time, so I'll tell you. There are so many things that's hard about being a parent, but I think in the top three, if not number one, is that you never know if you made the right choice for your kid until the end of the process. You never know. Because you make your choice and it might take years to see what outcome actually occurred. So you never know until it's too late. It makes the decision-making process agonizing. In this case, did you have something?
I agree with you that there may be like an underlying where subconsciously you're thinking, you know, you may not be making that decision. But I was also thinking seeing the first choice on the product could be the reason that some people pick it up that would like never pick it up, you know, for any other reason. Like they had to talk to their doctor. So, you know, that, I mean, that's obviously going to have some like of their sale.
It's true, although I think if I understand, I'm sorry, I still can't pronounce it. Point. This is not something that you're going to just run out to the grocery store and pick up the brand for the first time, in all likelihood. It's going to be an ongoing deliberative process, trying to figure out, you know, you're going to make a choice once and you're likely going to stick with it because it's part of your whole lifestyle. At that point. So, I mean, this is a very significant choice in a new parent's decision. One that's unlikely to be made on the spot simply through product inspection. But don't forget, it's not just the advertising on the product itself, it's in all their marketing campaigns. Everywhere they're saying, first choice of doctors.
The case gave an example of another claim.
1.1% of pediatricians preferred Similac, 1% preferred Enfamil, 0.9% preferred something else, and 97% that they were all functionally identical. If this is the data, is this claim now rendered false? Okay, so you know the next question. When does it go from being acceptable to false?
Well, the 38% is really close to majority.
So this number you like?
Yes.
What about this number?
Well, if you compare 25% to...
That's it. As I said, these may not be correctly comparable. If you have... So what are you looking for? When will you know you got there?
Well, I'm looking for majority out of those who actually made the choice.
A majority. Okay, well, let's change the facts. Let's get rid of this 0.9%, okay? We got 1.1%, 1%, and 98%.
Because
most of them don't make any choice. So, does everyone understand the import of this question? What's going to happen here? Do you think that the marketing people at Similac went forward without talking to lawyers?
They
had lots of conversations with the lawyers. And the lawyers say, what do you got for me? And they say, we got a plurality, guys. Can we make a claim for a choice of doctors based on the plurality? Say. How good's your plurality? Is that your answer? You see where I'm going with this? The answer is critical to understanding. Your clients are going to bend on you to bend as far as possible and say, green light this. Because I can make an argument, we have a plurality. This case tells me, I have a plurality. That's all I needed.
That's why they didn't say first choice of most doctors. It could be that first choice of most doctors, or it could be that the first choice of some doctors, which I also think is possible.
You would read first choice of doctors as being the same claim as first choice of some doctors?
Well, you could read it that way.
Okay. I would not read it as, I would not interpolate the word some without expressly being there. I would think of that as a very different claim.
Well, I don't think it's possible for Similac to ask each and every doctor in this country. So it must be some doctors.
We're back to the substantiation. Yeah. How you know, you're going to work on a survey and you got all the same biases of the survey that we just talked about with consumer surveys.
It's just because
it's not possible to ask
everyone, so it must be some. And then the question is, how many?
How many would green light the first choice of doctors claim based on the evidence that we had here? How many would, no, let's see some hands. So one, two, three. No. The rest of you would say no go? Can't make it?
I think I'd prefer to green light if there was an asterisk after the first choice of doctors and on the back of the packaging, it stated the number of doctors percentage, so 25-40% or something like that.
So, one way to potentially address this is by changing the claim somehow or another. I mentioned one claim that could be made. First choice of doctors among doctors who state a preference. Right? That's a substantiated claim. They could have said that claim. They didn't. Another is, you say, first choice of doctors, asterisk. And then asterisk, you say, here's how we reach this conclusion. Does that work? Does that solve the problem here? A disclosure, first choice of doctors, asterisk, with all the data that makes it, that clarifies how you got there? Right, you guys remember from our discussion about disclosures that disclosures are a common attempt to solve problems with a claim, and they sometimes work, and sometimes they don't, and the fact that they are indeterminate in advance is part of the challenge that we have as lawyers negotiating with our clients, is we're going to say, put all this stuff there, and clients say, A, I don't want to, and B, it might not even work. So why are you recommending me to do something I don't want to do? Right, okay, so just recognize, this claim could be modified in either by expressly qualified within the context of the claim or through a disclosure done somewhere else to try and fix it. And depending on what you're willing to do, that might have been part of the problem. I got it. Yeah, I'm so confident. That negotiation took place among the lawyers here. Right, that the lawyer's like, well, what if we put the asterisk there? What if we add two more words? What? They went through all those scenarios to try and figure out what they could say. Question is, would you green light this in this needed form?
Yeah.
first choice of doctor and said you don't get to leave the house. You can leave that rhetorical, but there's no right answer to that question. It's really a personal inquisition, but you don't have to run through. Yes.
I agree. Of all the doctors that I surveyed, the majority of them had a preference, and it was similar.
So you would require a majority, not plurality.
Yeah. But then I would still have a problem with whether it was just the choice between Similac and Personal. Like, I think there's still an issue with the breast milk thing. Like, would doctors, if they, it feel like it's misleading if you say choice when the choices that you present to people are just the two formulas. Like, what if there's other choices too? Like, first choice between what? I just think that's and so I feel like it, first choice of doctors between instant formulas when asked about instant formulas or something like that, which sounds horrible. Anyway.
We're back in the lawyer's trap in the ad copy, and we're not good at it. We need to recognize our limitations.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
I think adding an answer can be much more comfortable with that. Do you think, like, what consumer value do you lose by adding it in terms of maybe the safety that you gain by adding it? Like, how many people even look at the asterisk and think to turn it over and figure out where it matches up and what exactly it is?
Of course, that's why it might not be effective. It's because we know that people aren't going to go and take a look at it. The social science on this is overwhelming. The qualifying information and then the disclosure doesn't change how people interpret the claim. It's exactly why it's a compromised solution that might make no one happy.
Yeah,
so
what was the outcome?
I'm sorry. So the district court said this claim was an impliedly false statement, was not adequately substantiated, it was impermissible. The appellate court reversed and had this confusing discussion about things that are misunderstood might not be misrepresentations, and it was baffling. I really couldn't make heads or tails of it. And so I'm sorry. The short answer was, this got a green light, this was okay to do, and that to me was unexpected.
So now the goal is that you can make these kind of claims without
in theory, you should be able, whenever you can show a plurality, unless you're dealing with these extreme situations, you should be able to claim first choice of X whenever you can show the plurality of the instrument. That's what this case could be interpreted to stand for. I wouldn't rely upon that outside the Seventh Circuit, personally.
The
takeaway is the personal introspection question, frankly.
Yeah.
So how are you going to push back when someone comes to your test and says, do you like this? And, to recognize, to use this as another example of how you parse not the literal claim, but all the implied claims as well, and how you substantiate them. Everyone knew what was going on here. This is not something where Similac was surprised that people got the implied message. I've seen cases like that. This is not one of them. This is one where it's your job to go and get the right information. Now remember, we're teaching this as part of the survey. So then the next question is, how are you going to do your surveys in a way that's going to substantiate these claims? Notice that there was lots of survey evidence introduced, and all of it was subject to this attack. What did it show and what didn't it show? Here, what was so remarkable is that the surveys actually reached some points that everyone agreed upon. We actually had consensus here. Many doctors didn't have a preference. Those who did preferred some luck. The surveys actually gave us a consistent answer to it that was usable. We don't normally get that, frankly. Any other questions or comments on the Mead-Johnson versus Abbott case?
Let's start to talk a little bit about remedies.
When I teach contract law, I teach my students one thing. I say, you've got to get this one point, and if you don't get this, you're not going to get it. I teach my students it's all about the remedies. You have to think about what remedies you want and can get before you think about what contract you put in place. So here we've decided to expressly break out remedies and put them in a very prominent place.
those who took the IP survey class with me, as you recall, we just had a little bit on remedies, right? Every now and then it was like, oh, and here's some remedies as well. But here we're putting remedies front and center in the material because it's an integral part of how you think about the claim. What's so interesting about the remedies here is that there's some unique twists about how you fix the basic problem. One of the philosophical questions that I would like you to wrestle with, and if we have time, we'll address it here, is how do you fix false advertising? What is the best way of solving the problem that's created by false advertising? You'll see we do a bunch of things to try and address it, query if they are the right things. So there are three main remedies that are available for a false advertising problem. There's injunctions, which is the typical or preferred remedy. There's damages, and there's criminal sanctions. And we will look at all three of these in more detail. Let's start with injunctions. Okay, let's start with the factors for a temporary restraining order or preliminary injunction. Again, this is stuff that comes up in every class, so we're just pointing out for our purposes here because of how it plays out for advertising cases. You have four factors. The first factor is you have to show a strong likelihood of success on the merits. If you're going in and seeking relief before the adjudication on the merits, you got to show that you're likely to win. You also have to show that there will be irreparable injury without injunctive relief. So you're going to the court and say, fix the problem here. If you don't, something bad will happen that cannot be fixed later. And irreparable for this purpose means you can't fix it by money damages. You can't just write a check and make up for all the harm that was suffered. Notice that Rebecca gave you the IDT versus CBT case, where basically the court said, I don't see the irreparable injury here. You think that these people are siphoning off your customers. We'll figure out how much they siphon and we'll write you a check. We could fix this problem through money damages. Historically, in advertising cases, irreparable injury was presumed. This was not really a contested factor. We just assumed that if we're dealing with false advertising, there were consumers being harmed, that was an irreparable injury, we need to fix it. Now, we have the eBay versus Merck Exchange case. Those of you who took the IP survey class, even not for me, I trust you covered this case. This is a case involving the patent claim where there was a preliminary injunction sought, and the court said just because we see a patent violation doesn't mean we have irreparable injury. We need to actually go through and look at the factors. What this has done in practice is it's made an open question. In the past, we would just assume there's irreparable injury, it would be check, 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 done, and now we actually have to look. Okay, the third requirement is we have to look to see what harm will be suffered by the defendant if the injunction is issued, how bad is the problem going to be imposed upon them. And then finally, we look at the public interest. Now notice that advertising cases, typically the public interest is pretty high. We're dealing with consumers who are being misled. And so we're very concerned about that interest. So the public interest will often work in the plaintiff's favor. Irreparable injury, even though it's an open question, is likely to work in the plaintiff's favor. So typically what we have is they're going to show a strong success on the merits, they're going to show that the plaintiff's likely to win, and then we have to take a look and say, is the relief being asked overly aggressive? You can see, though, why injunctions are the typical remedy for false advertising case, because this is typically something where if the plaintiff's likely to win on the merits, they're going to be able to get this preliminary injunction. Now, the standards for a permanent injunction are a little bit different. Here, we don't have to worry about a strong likelihood of success on the merits because we've already adjudicated it. They won. So now we're looking to say, what are the factors? We take a look at whether the remedies of law are inadequate. So once again, we're basically looking to say, well, what other remedies do we got here? And if we don't have any good remedies of law, then we look at our equitable remedies.
We look for the same irreparable injury. We do a balancing of hardship, so it's a slightly more favorable standard here. We're just saying, okay, well, what's the best balance between the plaintiff and defendant's burdens? And then finally, the public interest as well. There's a huge time element to the false advertising case. Remember, we talked about this. In many cases, there's an ad campaign taking place, and you want to stop that ad campaign. So the standards for a TRO or a preliminary injunction are often critical to whether you can actually get that campaign off the air or out of print on a timely basis. So this is, again, a very common calculus in a false advertising case. Questions about this slide? Okay, let's turn on to some specific types of injunctions that we've run into. The most common injunction, of course, is to say you've got to stop sending false advertising. So we would block the further dissemination of false advertising. And this is the one that you're going to expect as a matter of course if you actually win on the merits. In a permanent injunction, but even in a preliminary injunction, this would be the typical remedy. Now, there's a couple of additional remedies that you can get here. The book talks a little bit about fencing in orders, where the FTC would hit the plaintiff, sometimes would say, don't just stop the false advertising that you have made in the past. We're going to set up a category of things that are like what you've done in the past, and we're going to tell you you can't do those either. So we're going to create this buffer of activity around the thing that you did wrong and blacklist you from doing both. So the fencing in order basically says, we're going to constrain you to a narrower playing field than what you used to have in the past because you have shown yourself to be a transgressor. The FTC also has the power to seek an exclusion order, which basically says, you're out of the industry. This is obviously a very heavy remedy. But there are certain people, as Ms. Lifelong and I were talking about, you just simply say, that's it. You are so untrustworthy in this industry, out you go, find a new profession. Okay, another type of injunction is corrective advertising or consumer education. So if you think about the harm of false advertising, it's teaching people to make a choice they may not want to make. Or a choice that's not appropriate. So we might teach them to fix that by teaching them how to make the right choice for themselves. Or teaching them, giving them more information to make a more balanced choice. So we can order the defendant to basically advertise to fix whatever it did wrong. And say, yes, you need to keep advertising, but you need to now tell people I did something wrong so that you'll inflate them you'll re-educate them about the error that you made. And in Landon Act cases, Rebecca mentioned, a lot of times the courts are more interested in seeing the plaintiff do counter-advertising than to do corrective acts. They're less interested in making the defendant correct a bone error and saying, you know what, look, let's just make sure that you, as an adversary in the marketplace, go and educate the consumers directly. So they, you know, kind of want the spirited jousting. That's a more typical approach. And another injunction that's possible is to actually have a product recall or destruction. Say, you know what? This false advertising was so bad, we got to take those products off the shelf. We got to go and have a big bonfire. Not common, but in an appropriate circumstance, this is actually the right answer. That there's a problem here that cannot be fixed. Just by telling consumers more, it has to be literally ripped off the shelves. Yeah.
So if the case turned out the other way, maybe the former case probably would have brought a recall with you lately, or just, would that be a big story split up or whatever?
Yeah, so that's a good question. What would be the appropriate remedies in that first choice of doctors? We would expect that you would have, you can't make that claim going forward, so you got to stop it on the ongoing basis. But you got millions of units on the shelf, and you've got ads in our process. And what are you going to do about that? You have a bunch of things in process that you might say,
Would you think that it would be worth ripping that one off the shelves for that claim?
To get the price tag to be placed over it, right?
My guess is that they wouldn't even go that far. They would simply say, you know what, you did wrong, you're going to write a check to your competitor, so you know, we'll have the money moving to make up for that, and then we're just going to let that harm continue on in the marketplace until the stocks are clear. That would be my guess on that. You can do some corrective stuff as well and say, hey, you know, when we said first choice doctors, we weren't talking about breast milk, and by the way, many doctors have no preference. You can imagine that as an appropriate remedy as well. So you might look at this as a hierarchy, and this would be at the bottom. This is the one. This is just socially wasteful, right? I mean, now this product, the product isn't bad for the, remember, we have a good problem here. There are two strong choices in the marketplace for formula. So it's not like the formula is bad, it's just being oversold. And so we probably don't want to waste all that formula and say it's available to nobody. We'd say, let's find another way to fix it. The stuff like stickering is a possibility, and as a plaintiff, you ask for all of that. Right? You put all that on the list. Say, here's all the X, Y, Z I'd like to have happen, and you see what you can get away with.
Do you have an example of a recent
issue? Well, we were just talking about one. Can you share your... He's been selling... What has he been selling? Supplements or weight loss?
Television shopping for pads, so we really don't like him.
What did he sell, though? What's that? Weight loss
products? Oh, yeah, infomercial products, weight loss, energy, et cetera, et cetera. But then he had an order from FTC that he could no longer participate in pretty much all commerce at all.
I think at minimum it said no infomercial.
Well, yeah, but I don't think he's not allowed to sell anything on television ever again except books. Because book Kevin Trudeau, and the only reason they let him sell books is because of his, apparently they thought he had a First Amendment right to sell books. So what he does is he sells books. He'll tell you to go to his webpage and subscribe to his newsletter, where he tells you about health stuff, which is all about, what's he call it, some kind of energy stuff. And it's totally made up. He was in jail for 2 years for fraud before he got into television. So, and then he came to print and tried the same thing.
Basically, it's someone who was a key player on health claims, FTC is doing it, like, look, you're just out. You're on the sidelines.
You are too far. You know, you can take this pill, it will cure AIDS. That comes very broad.
Other questions or comments on the types of injunctions? Let's look at some of the defenses to the equitable relief here. Is there under the Lanham Act? Every doctrine has its own defenses. But under the Lanham Act, here's some of the common ones that you run into. First of all, there's delay or latches. And what's interesting is there's no express statute of limitations here. So there's not a specific time period that you simply know you're scot-free. We don't have that. We only have delay or latches as the limit on the claim. Now, sometimes the courts will import statute of limitations from analogous state claims. So they will try and say, well, the Lanham Act doesn't have statute of limitations. But this related state statute does, so we'll make that up. But instead, usually the battle is over delay or latches. And if you wait too long, you can be out of preliminary relief. Basically, if you're going to court saying, I need preliminary relief before you said I'm going to win, you need to be moving quickly enough so the court says, okay, I understand that there's a problem here that's really urgent. But if you're going to dilly-dally with your problem, and then you're going to come and say, got to give me urgent relief before we know if I'm going to win at the end, the courts get really suspicious. You saw that an unreasonable delay might even be a matter of a few months. So So delay is a common defense that we see in these cases. It's you generally, you, once you see that advertisement and you get a problem, you expect to be jumping on it. And if you're not, the defendant over time gets an increased opportunity to say, sorry, I'm not. You don't get relief. Remember, even if you don't get equitable relief, you still might get many damages. So this is not the end of the story. But this is obviously a key issue if you're trying to knock somebody out of the marketplace quickly. And it can even affect permanent injunction if you can show that the defendant was prejudiced by the delay. And I don't have a good example about that, but there are circumstances where you say, you know what, because you waited so long, it's now too late for us to fix the problem.
Another relief that's mentioned is acquiescence. If the plaintiff has somehow acquiesced or consented impliedly to the behavior, I don't see that too often. Another one is mootness.
This is a very common one. So the mootness occurs when the defendant stops a conduct that someone's trying to enjoin with no reasonable expectation of resuming. So what happens? Advertiser runs its ad campaign. They stop the ad campaign per its normal terms. Then they get sued, and the plaintiff says, I want to stop you from ever making that campaign again. But our campaign's over. Your claim is moot. Most courts will say, unless there's some clear reason why you really have stopped it permanently, we're going to go ahead and lock you in and say you've got to go ahead and stop the claim. So a mootness claim normally doesn't work, but it's a common one because whenever the ad campaign is run, it's out of the cycle. It's a standard thing given the time, the temporal nature of these claims. And finally, another defense to equitable relief is unclean hands. You guys are familiar with this concept, right? That the plaintiff is engaged in the behavior that they're complaining about, and therefore they don't accord and they don't deserve equitable relief because they are not clean. We do have plenty of examples of these, and as the book has indicated a number of times, there's a fair number of circumstances where competitors emulate each other in advertising campaigns, and then there becomes an industry-wide problem. And then all those people in the industry have a tough time of complaining about each other's behavior because they have such clean hands. The book actually gave me, I thought, a really good example, this case involving litigation over DMV.org. And the plaintiffs in that case had done a whole bunch of things that were designed to look like DMV-related websites as well. So it's like, are you serious? Come on, guys. And the court said, ultimately, even though you had clean hands, I'm still going to block it because of the public interest. But the court then denied damage in that case, basically saying, sorry, I'm not going to do everything you ask because you're kind of a scum as well. Questions about these defenses to the Lanham Act claims for equitable relief?
Okay, let's talk about money damages. So the statute says that the money damages can include defendant's profits, damages to the plaintiff, and the cost of the action. Let's take a look at each of these in more detail. But before we do that, recognize that this is actually not what it seems. It's actually hard to get damages in Lanham Act cases. And the book talked a little about this, but basically a number of courts have required that there be some evidence of consumer deception before they're willing to grant damages. They'll give the injunction. They'll say, okay, you're on the sidelines with this. Now, if you want to move a check, hold on a sec. I want to actually see if there was some reason why consumers got hurt in this process. So, consumer deception is kind of a barrier that the courts impute here. The reality is that you're not automatically going to get your damages in a successful land in that case. It's not,
it doesn't follow from victory.
Okay. The way we, with respect to defendant's profits, again, we have some barriers here.
There are courts that require evidence of the defendant's scienter before they will award the defendant's profits. So again, it's not just automatic. Okay, you know, find out how much the defendant made and let's get the money. Some courts will require the scienter before they'll award this piece. The typical formula, this should look very familiar for you to remember the remedies in copyright or trademark cases. It's the same basic formula that we use in those cases as well. You start out with a plaintiff has to show the revenues that are attributable to false advertising, and then the defendant has to show any deductions against that revenue. Everyone understands the difference between revenue and profit. Revenue, top line. Profit, you take away costs. So all the plaintiff has to do is show the revenues, top line. It's the defendant's burden to try and convert that into a profit statement. We saw this in copyright and trademark cases as well. This is obviously an area that is room for plenty of negotiation. Okay. In addition, as you saw, the Lanham Act allows you to get damages suffered by the plaintiff. And some examples of that might be deferred sales that they would have gotten but for the false advertising, or reduced prices where they had to drop their price to compete because they could no longer sustain their actions otherwise. Some kind of harm to their goodwill, consumers thinking less of them. Or any cost of counter-advertising, if they had to ratchet up their ad campaign to try to combat the false advertising. All of these are possible, but they all have to be shown. So it's easy to say, here's what you're looking for, you've got to actually show the evidence to connect the dots. It's also possible to treble these damages. The Lanham Act allows that. Obviously, it has to be pretty egregious before the court will do so. Remember, they're not likely to... they're not going to award damage to the matter, of course, anyway. So the treble damages is an exceptional case of a very strong case in the first place. And, of course, you can't double dip. So to the extent that these overlap with these, then you don't get both. You only get one way of getting the same basic payoff. And then the case under case costs. Costs are... the filing costs of the court, basically. So these are a relatively small number. These are not things like experts or surveys where some big bucks are incurred out of pocket. These are just the costs of the court. Punitive damages are not available, so we don't talk in terms of punitives. If there are any punitive damages, they come in a sense through this treble damage award. But all of this isn't designed to be punitive. This is simply to disgorge the benefit and fix the harm. And then attorney's fees are available, but they're always discretionary, and they're only available in, quote, exceptional cases. The case book gave you an example that even the defendants can get attorney's fees in exceptional cases, so it's bidirectional. But these are fairly rare. We just don't see that many awards of attorney's fees because... exceptional. The courts have interpreted that pretty literally. I just want to move on. I'm sorry. Any questions or comments on money damages? Let me just mention briefly about class action settlements. So we mentioned how important class actions are to false advertising cases. And settlements are obviously an integral part of any class action consideration. As I said, once you get class certification, settlements are much more forthcoming. But it is possible to settle even before you get class certification. And the standards for class action settlements are that it has to be fair, reasonable, and adequate. We're quite understood what the word adequate adds to that discussion, but let's assume for a moment that it's part of it. And those words mean nothing. So the courts have developed some guidelines about what might help us understand if they were fair, reasonable, and adequate. That includes things like arm's length negotiations, was there actually a bona fide negotiation between the plaintiff and the defendant, was there enough discovery to figure out who was likely to win, are the litigants experienced enough, so particularly if this plaintiff's counsel, do they know what they're doing, and
How many of the class objected to the settlement?
So these are just some guidelines to help evaluate it. Notice what happens in practice here is that once a settlement is reached, both the plaintiff and defendant want to make it happen. So the only people who are pushing back on the settlement are anyone who's objecting, or the judge saying, come on, you guys. You guys have not done your deal. Notice that the attorneys or the plaintiff, once they strike a settlement, they just want to get paid. Right? So they're willing to say, you know what, we did nothing for our class, but we got a settlement, so let's get approved. So nobody's fighting that settlement. The judge has to stand up and say, hold on a sec. Is this really a fair deal for consumers? I'm out of time. Let me stop there. I have a few more things to say about settlements. Just a couple words about insurance coverage and criminal violation. How many of you have not taken either the IP survey class or copyrights? Okay. So we're going to totally shift gears starting next week. We will have concluded our discussion about false advertising, and we will move to talk about intellectual property. We have 4 weeks of discussion about intellectual property starting next week with copyrights. For those of you who have found false advertising to be rather rule-driven, copyrights will be a little bit easier, perhaps. And also, it'll be more fun because we'll have a chance to look at some more apps. So, why don't we suspend our discussion there? I will see you guys on Monday.
Confess to having just recorded your class quite unintentionally. I left this after my class. And
I did not double check it, but you used
right, you've got it too.
I'm sorry, y'all.